iconic driving home for Christmas has died at the age of 74. We'll be looking back on his life and career in just a few moments' time. 6:45.
Coming up at 7 on LBC, Ian Dale.
At 9, are we too relaxed about drink driving? At 8, why do so few of us have any interest in learning a foreign language? But first, why is Labour so determined to pick a fight with the countryside interests?
Ian Dale, at 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
This Christmas, McDonald's and the Elf on the Shelf are bringing festive tasks to your little ones, like writing a Christmas card for your postie.
Thank you. You're one happy helper.
Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 30th of December, from 11 a.m, includes one pre-selected book or toy, while stocks last, subject to availability, fair ordering policy applies.
At Lidl, you can get a whole Christmas dinner for eight for under £1.30 per person with all the trimmings, including fresh Birchwood British whole turkey, potatoes, Yorkshire stuffing, sprouts, carrots, parsnips, and of course the gravy. Lidl, more to value. Subject to availability, selected stores, GB only. Fresh turkeys on sale 19th of December. See lidl.co.uk/lbtv for details.
Calling all young creatives. It's time to get prepped for the journalism industry. And where better than Global Academy? Here's Molly, a journalism student in Year 12.
Outside of the classroom, we run our own news platform called The Loop. I do a daily news bulletin and produce videos for socials. We learn everything we need to be a journalist and have even learned alongside the news team at Global.
Global Academy. Apply now and join us in Years 10 or 12. GlobalAcademy.com.
Serious about the right vitamins for you and your family? Trust Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company, for expert nutritional care for every age and lifestyle. Vitamins for everyone, including Well Man, Well Woman, Well Baby and Well Kid. From Boots, Pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com. For number one verification, see Vitabiotics.com.
This is LBC with Tom Swarbrick. Text 84850.
Andy's in Bishop Stortford. Hi, Andy.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm well, sir. Now, as an ex-traffic officer, you'll be able to give us some good background on this. Why do we have any allowance of alcohol before people get behind the wheel of a car?
So, the legislation goes back right back to the 1800s, but in 1964, there was a study done by, in America, called the Grand Rapids Effect, and it basically said that a legal limit of 80 micrograms per 100 millilitres of blood, you're more likely to be involved in an accident. So they basically did a study and they basically said at this level of alcohol,
yep,
you are more impaired, likely to be, yep, involved in a collision.
So so if you say, well, you've got 30, might make you more likely than zero, but not likely enough to be a danger?
Yes. But the other side to look at it is that the legislation is really comes in two parts, because back in the sort of when the legislation started, it was known as being unfit through drink, and that was the sort of study. So it was only until the sort of 1960s when breath test machines came in that they actually set the legal limit. Now, it could be fair to say that someone could take a glass of wine and a painkiller and be unfit through drink. So they could be observed driving and then be weaving in the lane, yeah, failing to sort of signal, etc. So the legislation is quite complicated and it sort of comes in two parts, but it's only really people understand this the level.
They understand the level, but I don't know
35.
Yeah, but I don't know what would take me over the level. So the safest thing, therefore, is obviously to have zero alcohol, but the law allows you, yes, to have a little bit of alcohol, but no one, yes, really knows what that is, and how could they, because it's so dependent on your size, how much you've had to eat, what drink you're having, how much of it you drink,
yes,
etc.
But if you're observed by a police officer to be driving and you are unfit, then you can still be prosecuted for driving a motor vehicle whilst unfit, but you would need to demonstrate by evidence. And there's sort of checks that police officers can do in what was called a field impairment test, where you can actually see if someone is unfit to drive. So the whole thing about 35 is that that's the limit that people look at. So if you had your last caller talked about the three rugby lads having three pints,
yeah,
and you said that it was a case of, yes, they'd be quite merry at that point. If they got behind the wheel, and were driving poorly to the extent where they could actually cause a collision, and it was observed by a police officer, it doesn't matter what the number comes back as, they would still be prosecuted for driving whilst
unfit. You could have, okay, so very hypothetical, you could be massively over the limit, but as long as a police officer doesn't see you driving in an unfit fashion...
No, because then if you're stopped and do a roadside breath test, say, I've arrested people who I have stopped for another offence, and then they've been driving absolutely fine, but then smelt alcohol on them, done a roadside breath test, and they've come back at 100.
God. More than three times over?
Yeah, more than three times over the limit. So the legislation is very comprehensive with regards to drink drive, and I think you really need to understand it in its full terms to actually sort of... So about 35 is pretty much, that's the thing that everyone focuses on. Everyone thinks that they can have, you know, one drink, two drinks, and you said about people's different sizes, but it's still... the legislation itself is very good.
You could still be done for unfit driving, even if you're below. Andy, I appreciate it. That's very, very helpful background. Just for clarity, just make it zero. As Amanda says here, in Scotland, we have zero alcohol by law before driving. What's the really good explanation for why it isn't exactly zero? Has Andy just done it and I've missed it? 0345 606 0973 is the number. 6:52. Next.
Driving home for Christmas, yeah.
Well, see the breaking news this afternoon that Chris Rea, famous for that Christmas classic Driving Home for Christmas, has died. Kelly Allen is assistant celebrity editor at Fabulous Magazine. Thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme, Kelly. That's the song we all know him for. Was it a one and done for Chris Rea? Was that his only big hit?
No, he had other hits, but I think that is the one that will sort of be him, what he'll be remembered for. I mean, he had a long sort of career. Like, that song came out, I'm actually having a blank of when exactly it came out. But, you know, it's been in the charts since, like, 2021, I think, or 2001, 2007, it has been in the top 10 every year at Christmas.
No way.
I know, it's crazy. And it's one of the Christmas classics. Yeah, like, he's sort of like, he had, basically since 2016, he'd released two albums, Song for a Lover 2017, One Fine Day in 2019. Like, he has quite a big back catalogue of music. It's just that song is the song that everybody really sort of associates with him.
What kind of music was he then known for outside of Christmas hits?
Oh, God. I don't know. Do you know what? You put me on the spot. I'm not a huge Chris Rea fan. I am...
Devastating. You're not a big fan, Kelly. I wonder to what extent that was true for, frankly, lots of other people, given that, the thing that he is most well known for is one hit.
I think that's it. But you know what? Yeah, if you remember the film about a boy, you get one hit and you make a lot of money. I know, I think Wizard have said that too, that you get those big Christmas hits back in the day and they paid the bills the rest of the year. So maybe he didn't have as much pressure on him to make the music as other people because that song did go into the charts every single year and do well. But yeah, I mean, I do know he had lots of albums. I admit I'm not a fan of. I'm not a fan. I haven't listened. Mostly rock music, I think.
Do we know what led him to write the song, the circumstances in which he wrote the classic?
Yeah, he wrote it about his wife. And actually, I learned something just a couple of days ago. I didn't know that he was quite skint when he wrote it. And also, he had just lost his driving license. He'd been caught by the police. I think he might have been drink driving. And he didn't have his license, so he was not driving home for Christmas. And he wrote the track. And he'd said previously that he didn't even want to release the track. He didn't want a Christmas song hanging around. But the record label really liked it and thought it would be a big hit, which they were obviously right about, and they insisted he did release it, which has been great for us.
Well, and great for him as well. It's a good thing that the record label won out in that sense.
Yeah, definitely it does. I mean, it is a classic, and even I think interestingly, just hours before his death was announced today, there was a post on Instagram from him with like a snowy sort of scene set with like a sign on the motorway saying "Driving Home for Christmas with 1,000 Memories," and a lot of people will be driving home this week and be listening to that song and thinking of that.
Well, as you say, Kelly, it's been a Christmas classic since, I think, released back in the 80s. Thank you so much for your time. Kelly Annan is Assistant Celebrity Editor at Fabulous Magazine on the life and times of Chris Rea, who has died today, aged 74. Paul's a new caller in Carlisle. Hi, Paul.
Hello, mate. Regarding the drunk driving and licensing problems, I'm a type 1 diabetic, have been since I was one. In 1997, I had a quite bad car crash, my fault. Luckily, only me. But the police and ambulance come. From there, the policeman took all my details and that. And as soon as I mentioned being diabetic, he wrote something down. It happened on a Sunday morning, and then within a week, it was the following Saturday, I got a letter from the DVLA saying, as of now, your licence is being revoked for a minimum of 6 months. Mm. And then from there, I had to prove, which took another 6 months of monthly checkups at the hospital, blood tests, etc., to say that my diabetes was under control. So I lost my licence for a year, basically, until I could prove that I was fit to drive. So with regard to drunk driving, how does that work? You know, I mean, I resent people who drink drive.
Yeah, it does seem extraordinary that you can be shown to be over the limit, having caused, in the case of this poor family, the death of their loved one, and still have your licence be driving around whilst you're waiting for your day in court.
Yeah, exactly. Strange. Exactly. I fully agree. And like with my, in my case, luckily nobody else was involved at all. It's just that I lost control. So I had to accept that. I've got no argument. But like I say, within a week, no license for a year.
Yeah, it's very, and gosh, that it changes the game, doesn't it? If you've suddenly gone from being able to drive to not being able to drive overnight, it can be really, really tricky. Paul, thank you for the call. John's in Camden. Hi, John.
Hi, mate. You okay?
Yeah, good, sir. Thoughts?
Yeah, it's very similar to your last one, actually. But it's a good friend of mine, and he had a letter for the Post all about this drink driving and drug driving. He was a 7.5-ton delivery driver, and he had a letter through the Post revoking his license on the back of an anonymous tip-off.
That's weird.
And he had to go to the doctors for, I can't think how long, 12 months, 2 years, every 3 months, every 2 months. He passed all of them, and they said, well, wouldn't give him his license back without doing this.
And what did the tip off say?
Well, they wouldn't tell him.
Oh, God. He lost his driving license.
He was quite sure he'd gone for a breakup. He said he'd gone for a breakup.
Oh, okay.
A bit of animosity behind it, I think.
Well, yeah, okay.
But to me, that's fair enough. But if you know what I mean, it's fair enough to be tipped off and to chase that up. That's good. That's good. But if someone goes then and has a clear test at the doctor straight away,
yeah, exactly. That feels that feels incredible that they'd be able to take your license off you just because of anonymous tip off that can't be proven. John, appreciate the call. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you for all your calls throughout the programme today. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all the latest news and opinion. Put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind Love Radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the all-new official LBC app for free from your app store now. Back with you tomorrow from 4. Ben Kentish here with you at 10. Next, Ian Dale.
Thanks, Tom.
There is some trail hunting that is a smokescreen for fox hunting.
You'll be delighted to hear that the new government strategy to get us all on side is to, wait for it, pick as many fights as possible. What a time to be alive, eh? So in this vein, the government has announced that as part of a new animal welfare strategy, it's going to ban the practice of trail hunting, which doesn't actually involve animals. You couldn't make it up. It's yet another sign that Labour has no understanding of the countryside and no clue. At 8, Larry Lamb, late of this parish, has railed against his fellow Brits for having little or no interest in learning foreign languages. And at 9, are we too relaxed about drink driving in this country?
on your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 7 o'clock, singer-songwriter Chris Rea, the man behind Driving Home for Christmas, has died at the age of 74. He sold millions of records in the 70s and 80s and won Brit Awards. Music journalist Matt Charlton has told LBC he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and had his pancreas removed in 2001.
But we hadn't heard much about any other health issues, and this apparently, as we've just heard, was a short illness. It's just such a strange thing that it so often happens around Christmas time that we lose people associated with Christmas. We lost George Michael on Christmas Day 2016. It's just this horrible, horrible irony.
A man has been charged with dozens of offences against his then-wife, including drugging and raping her. Five other men are also accused of sexually assaulting Joanne Young. LBC's Theo Ricard has more.
Detective Superintendent Jeff Smith from Wiltshire Police says this is a significant update in what he calls a complex and extensive investigation. He says Joanne has been supported by specially trained officers from the beginning of the process, and she's made the decision to waive her right to anonymity following multiple discussions with officers and support services.
Shropshire's Fire and Rescue Service says it's extremely fortunate no one was injured after a canal's banks broke earlier. More than 10 people had to be rescued, and a major incident was declared in Whitchurch this morning. Large volumes of water escaped onto land and several narrow boats were left stranded. Two men have been jailed for using a dating app to trick victims into letting them into their homes before stealing their phones. 23-year-old Ramat Mohammadi and Mohammed Hotak, who's 27, would use the devices to make online payments and transfer themselves money. They were jailed for more than 8 years between them earlier. And the company behind TGI Fridays has filed to appoint administrators for the second time this month. Liberty Bar and Restaurant Group, which has 49 sites across the UK, wants to give itself more time to secure a rescue deal. 2,000 people work for them. In the city, the FTSE 100 has closed down 31 points at 98.65. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.14. LBC weather turning cloudy for most overnight. A few spots of rain developing in western areas, lows of 4. A murky day tomorrow with some light rain in the west. Some brighter spells for western areas too. Breezy in the south and east, highs of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ian Dale.
Hello, a very good evening. It's 3 minutes past seven on LBC. I'm Ian Dale, not in for anybody. I'm going to be in for people the rest of the Christmas holiday, but not quite yet. I'm here with you today and tomorrow. Then Christmas Eve, I'm going to be Sheila Fogarty. Christmas Day, I'm going to be James O'Brien. Boxing Day, in fact, sort of right from then on until Sunday, I'm going to be James O'Brien. I mean, can you believe that? So, one of the things I really like about the Christmas period is we won't have so many guests, so we can have lots and lots and lots of phone calls. So there's going to be a lot more opportunity for you to get on the air if you phone in over the next few days. Not because we're lazy in booking guests, but there's usually not so much news that happens over Christmas, so we don't have to sort of clog up the programme with important people. We have important people like you to come on the programme. 0345 6060 973. And I think this first subject that we're going to cover tonight is probably going to provoke a lot of people into ringing in. Because the government apparently has adopted a new strategy, and it's to pick fights with people. I'm serious. They think that that is the way that they're going to get more popular. Because if you look at their opinion poll ratings at the moment, they've now fallen behind the Conservatives. That's how bad it has got for Labour. They've fallen behind the Greens. That's how bad it's got.
And they seriously think that by picking fights with people, they're going to get people back on side. Well, jog on. I mean, if that really is the way that they want to govern this country, they don't deserve to govern this country, do they? Now, today they've released their animal welfare strategy, which a lot of things in it I kind of agree with. Trail hunting is one, though, that I think is going to be possibly the most controversial measure, because trail hunting is set to be banned in England and Wales as part of this animal welfare strategy, which is a little bit ironic when you think that not a single animal is killed on trail hunts. Well, the idea is that they aren't. Now, the argument goes, well, yes, but hunts, they may say they're going for they're going on trail hunting, but in effect, the hounds go off the scent and then still kill foxes. Well, nobody's ever proved the extent of that. But I think I hesitate to use the phrase killer arguments here, is that if trail hunting is banned, what happens to all of the hounds? What happens to all of the people who are employed by the hunts? There are apparently 10,000 hounds in this country, which presumably would all have to be put down. So this animal welfare strategy of Labour could lead to 10,000 hounds being put down. Now, I'm totally in favour of banning fox hunting. I think that that ban was the time that had come. So don't get me wrong. I'm not somebody who's wanted to bring back fox hunting. But I do think that this is sort of using a sledgehammer to crack a nut, and it's yet more indication that Labour seems to have a real problem with the countryside. They've never really understood the countryside, which, given that 100 of their MPs now represent rural constituencies, is interesting. Well, the Environment Secretary, Emma Reynolds, has spoken to reporters to explain why the government wants to ban trail hunting.
The Lassalle government, as you'll know, banned fox hunting, and we do think that there is some trail hunting that is a smokescreen for fox hunting. So we don't want to see fox hunting in the countryside. It's illegal, but we also think that trail hunting has been a way for people to try and get around that ban.
Well, give us the proof on that then, if that really is the case. I mean, I've seen all sorts of statistics going around today. None of them seem to be definitive. But why do we need a new law to do this? Because if there are sort of many hunts that do this, deliberately go off the scent of the trail and then go and hunt foxes anyway, well, take them to court. I mean, it's quite simple. That's what we have a law there to do. Why do we need a new one? Well, this is going to go out to consultation. Well, let's talk to people from both sides of the argument before I come to your calls. Mike Nicholas joins me from the animal welfare charity, the League Against Cruel Sports. Mike, very good evening. Why is a ban on this necessary?
Currently, the hunts are out chasing and killing animals as they were doing before the ban. We've had over 200 reports since the start of August of foxes being chased. When those foxes are chased, they meet a pretty grisly end. They're going to be torn apart by those hounds. So that's why we need new, stronger, more effective hunting laws that will actually end fox hunting once and for all. I mean, it's a hugely unpopular activity. The vast majority of people, when I speak to them, from different political persuasions, are opposed to it. They're horrified by it. So we had a chance 20 years ago to end it once and for all. Now the next year is an amazing opportunity to finally end it.
So how many foxes are actually still being killed?
We've had 200 reports of foxes being chased since the beginning of August.
Chased is different from being killed, isn't it?
Yeah, so we also get many reports of foxes being killed. Basically, they're eviscerated when they're torn apart by the hounds. I've spoken quite regularly to many people who go out and monitor fox hunts, and it's one of the most distressing things, I think, they've seen, watching or seeing these animals literally being torn apart. So it's still going on. It's still going on as it did before the ban. and it's time for change. It's time for stronger fox hunting laws. So we support the government's consultation.
But there is a fox hunting law. So why can't that law be deployed? Because I'm sure you have people monitoring these hunts that take videos and pictures of what happens. So if you've got the evidence, then sue the hunt, take them to court.
That's the problem, is that the law is not strong enough. There are too many loopholes in it. The hunts claim they are trail hunting, but this really is a smokescreen to conceal old-fashioned illegal hunting.
It may be for some, and I'm not disputing that. I'm sure there are some hunts that are doing this. But I asked my producer earlier, how many meets are there in a year of what used to be called fox hunts? And he said 15,000. Now, you're telling me that in 200 of those, there are incidents of where foxes have been chased, not necessarily killed, but chased. Now, that is not a big proportion, and I would have thought that the existing anti-fox hunting laws were fairly sufficient for you to use the evidence that you gather, and I know you do this, that just take them to court.
So, these are just the chases that have been witnessed. Thousands of other chases are going to go on unnoticed, unobserved, because nobody is monitoring the hunts. The sad reality is we've still got 175 fox hunts operating across England and Wales, and they are chasing and killing animals. They're also lying to the public. They claim they're trail hunting, but what they're actually doing is going after live foxes.
Yeah, and as I keep saying, there's a law to sort of bring them to book for that. Trail hunting in itself, I can't see why anyone would have an objection to that. And I'm sure there are one or two occasions when the hounds go off the scent and they might pick up a scent of a fox. And obviously that's very unfortunate when that happens. But that doesn't happen, as I understand it, that often.
Hunts are going out to chase and kill animals. What they're saying is that they're trail hunting, but this is an invention. It first emerged in about 2008, 2009, after the original fox hunting ban. It is an excuse. It is an excuse that's being used to fool the public, it's being used to fool the police, and it's being used to fool the courts. Now, the vast majority of the British population from all political parties actually are very much opposed to the chasing and killing of animals. They're opposed to fox hunting. So what we need now are new, stronger fox hunting laws. We need a ban on trail hunting. We also need to introduce an effective deterrent in the form of jail sentences for those that will go out and break the law. Once we have those new, stronger laws, then we can successfully prosecute anybody who wants to carry on fox hunting.
Now, you are, in effect, an animal welfare charity. How can you justify supporting this law when it will mean that thousands of hounds have to be put down?
The current reality is that hounds, when they get too old, when they reach the age of about 5 or 6, is that they're destroyed. The normal lifespan of a hound would be 10, 12 years. But that they simply not. They don't reach half that way. It's tragic. I've seen footage of the hunts just taking dogs out of the kennels and shooting them. What we'd love to do is rehome the hounds, find them a proper home where they get proper care and attention. But the reality for the hounds at the moment is a pretty miserable and very short existence. The hunts, sadly, although they claim they look after their animals, they dispose of them once they have no use to them anymore. So I think most people would be fairly horrified by that.
Okay, Mike, thank you very much. That's Mike Nicholas there from the League Against Cruel Sports. Well, Tim Bonner, I'm sure, is going to disagree with everything that Mike just said. He is Chief Executive of the Countryside Alliance. Tim, very good evening to you. Let's address that hounds issue first. Let's go in reverse. I mean, is what Mike said there true?
Well, I was at a kennels doing television interviews actually this morning from about 6 o'clock till 11 o'clock solidly. And I can tell you the hounds were very happy. They're an incredible breed, and they're one of the few types of dogs now which are kept as packs. So they have this sort of lifestyle where they have a pack structure, and they're obviously the huntsman who looks after them is the top dog, but they have a structure beyond that. They're amazing animals, and actually this year, if you want to go to Crufts, you'll see some hunting hounds being shown at Crufts for one of the first times they'll ever be there.
But Mike was making the point that after 5 or 6 years, they are generally put down.
Well, I've known hounds, and I hunted the back of beagles myself a long, long time ago, but I've known hounds into the 11th, 12th season. So, you know, hounds can live for a long time. They are very special. They live within a pack. It's very difficult for them to live with outside that pack. You know, but the idea that they're just disposable is frankly nonsense. They are hugely loved and very well looked after.
But if this trail hunting ban comes in, how many thousands of hounds would have to immediately be put down? Because, I mean, there's no way of keeping them, is there, otherwise?
Well, we're looking, and you're working on the basis of failure, and I'm an eternal optimist.
Well, no, I'm looking on the basis of success. Okay, fair enough. Yeah, but I'm looking at the different outcomes that could emerge from this. And I'm sure when the fox hunting ban was going through, you might have said something similar then. But are we talking about 10,000 hounds? That's the figure I've heard.
Well, there'd be more like 20,000 hounds in the country, I think, of all types, from foxhounds and bassets and beagles. There is going to be a future for hounds, though, and people that the hunts out across the country are so committed to those hounds. They adore them. They're not simply going to stand by and see their lives cut short or anything like that. And I think you'll see a very determined campaign, and you'll see people who, one way or another, will find a future for those hounds.
Okay, well, let's go back to the subject at hand, trail hunting, because the accusation is that many hunts, either deliberately or not, effectively use them as fronts for fox hunting, and that many foxes are killed even though fox hunting has been banned. You heard what Mike had to say. What's your view?
Yeah. Well, I have got some statistics which I can stand by, and I think that you will as well, because they come from the Ministry of Justice. And since 2010, there have been more prosecutions and convictions under the Hunting Act than any other piece of wildlife legislation. In fact, twice as many as others, as any other. I think it's over 700 people have been prosecuted, and over 400 people have been convicted under the Hunting Act. Now, most of those aren't related to the sort of hunts that your listeners would think about, you know, people on horses and all that sort of thing. But it is absolutely clear that as a piece of legislation, this works. You know, you cannot turn around and say that the most successful in terms of numbers piece of wildlife legislation in the country is something that doesn't work. If you are pursuing wild mammals with dogs, and you and I disagreed at the time when that was passed, and we'll leave that aside for the moment, but if you are doing it now, you will be convicted of an offence. The idea that the government has to go and relitigate an issue that it settled, you know, the Labour Party settled, in its own words, 20 years ago, is frankly mad. And we know why this is happening. It's got nothing to do with hounds or foxes or hunting. It's about this long-standing obsession that parts of the Labour Party and the animal rights movement has with hunting as an activity, and hunts in particular. And they think the Hunting Act has failed, not because you can't get convicted under it, because you clearly can, but because hunts still exist, and that is in itself offensive to some parts of the Labour Party. And it's an odd thing, but that is the reality of the situation.
Do you accept, though, that there are some hunts that are using trail hunting as a fig leaf for killing foxes?
Oh, and people have been prosecuted. Yeah, I'm not going to argue that. People have been prosecuted and convicted. So, you know, if they are doing this stuff, it is a perfectly enforceable piece of law. And, you know, as much as I vehemently disagree with the legislation that was passed, the fact is the law is the law. You should be obeying it. If you're not, you can, and as we see from the statistics, will be convicted of an offence. So why on earth is anyone suggesting that we need to go back? And you'll remember, Ian, the last time we did this, there were 700 hours of parliamentary time. It took 7 years. Yeah. It took the Parliament Acts. And even the Prime Minister at the time, you said that it was the domestic measure he most regretted in his time, Tony Blair. So why would a Labour government, which has said it wants to reconnect with the countryside, go down this route? I just don't understand it.
And how many jobs will be lost if this goes through? Because to my mind, that is a big factor here as well, because the Labour government make big play of the fact that they want economic growth, they want to create jobs, and yet here's another measure which inevitably will destroy jobs.
Yeah. Oh, there's There's hundreds of jobs directly related to hunts, so directly employed, thousands which are reliant on it. Yeah, possibly up to £100 million in terms of GDP. It's not a massive industry. It's not like farming. It's not like tourism. You know, hunting is broadly a hobby, not a business. But it's a really important social hub as well for so many communities, especially, frankly, those in quite remote rural areas where isolation and loneliness are particular issues. You know, to take that out, to take that those really important networks out of the countryside would be devastating for many people.
And it's often said that Labour doesn't understand the countryside. I mean, trail hunting is not really a particularly sort of an activity that's really always been associated with the countryside. I mean, is this really an example of them being anti-countryside?
I don't understand your first point, Ian. I mean, I don't think there could be more anything, frankly, that's more intrinsic to the countryside. Anywhere you go in the country, you know, from pubs to the names of the woods to street, there's everything. I mean, the hunting is so ingrained in the countryside. If you go to places like Gloucestershire or Leicestershire, the countryside has actually been built around hunting. The reason those woods are there that you see, the reason that hedges are there is because of hunting. So it is, it's fundamental to many, many different parts of the countryside. And I think it would have a really significant impact. Things have changed since 2000. Four when the legislation was passed, it came into force in 2005. There are still many, many hunts which are hugely supported, which are, you know, a sort of critical part of rural England and rural Britain. And so it would be sad, unnecessary, and frankly destructive to pass a piece of legislation which meant that they couldn't continue. But by the way, I don't think that'll happen. You know, I remain very optimistic that we will find a way through this.
Okay, Tim, thank you. That's Tim Bonner, Chief Executive of the Countryside Alliance. Well, we've heard from both sides there. Which side do you fall down on? 0345 6060 973. Are you someone like me who is broadly in favour of the ban on fox hunting when it eventually came in? Or do you think that, and I can't really see the logic for this, because it's not actually going, it's not only not going to save animals' lives, it's actually going to cost animals' lives as well as cost jobs. Is this just another example of Labour trying to pick a fight with people in the countryside? 0345 6060 973. It's 22 minutes past 7 on LBC.
This is LBC.
Ladies and gentlemen, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
This Christmas,
I came to Vienna to write for the Imperial Opera.
Experience an extraordinary tale of genius, jealousy, and rivalry.
We are enemies, you and I.
A brand new TV drama starring Will Sharp.
Very fancy.
And Paul Bettany.
I knew I was going to kill Mozart.
Amadeus. All episodes available now on Sky.
From now until the 18th of January, enjoy the extraordinary sale at Bicester Village. Shop up to 60% off the original retail price in select boutiques, including Lululemon, Penhaligon's and Vivian Westwood. T's and C's apply. See BicesterVillage.com. Bicester Village, what will you find?
Only 3 days to go until the big day, but you're busy endlessly scrolling for the gift your auntie wants that no store seems to have. There's no such thing as the perfect Christmas, but there are perfect moments. This year, make the most of moments that matter with Coca-Cola. Whether you're trying to track down the perfect gift or chatting with your colleagues about this year's Christmas party, refresh your holiday spirit with Coca-Cola, the perfect drink for sharing in the moment. Coca-Cola, holidays are coming.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
Leading Britain's conversation. Ian Dale. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
7:25. Strange tweet from Scott, who says, even the guy from the Countryside Alliance is embarrassed by Ian Dale's ludicrous suggestion that thousands of foxhounds will have to be put down. It's not a ludicrous suggestion at all. If the hunts can't exist, if they can't do trail hunting, then what happens to the hounds? They can't be rehomed as domestic pets because they're pack animals. So I don't know why that is a ludicrous suggestion, but Scott, feel free to ring in and tell me why. Gabriella is a first-time caller in Finchley. Hello, Gabriella.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. What would you like to say?
So, firstly, just to pick up on your rehomed point, they absolutely can be rehomed. All dogs are pack animals, and plenty of dogs end up getting rehomed after they've had training. You've got police dogs, dogs for the blind, etc. So they definitely can be.
Well, they're not pack animals.
Well, all dogs are naturally pack animals.
Well, yes, but most dogs are domestic pets right from the moment they're born. It's very different to say, well, so a dog that exists as a pack animal can then be retrained to be a domestic pet. I'm not sure that's right.
I mean, it's not the main point I want to make, but there are definitely places that will take in a couple of dogs at a time and keep them together. But I guess the point I really want to make is that the UK is one of the most nature-poor places in Europe. It is awful. We're a nation of animal lovers and we don't protect our wildlife, our countryside, etc. And the countryside is a lot more than just hunting. And I think the issue, I agree with you that, you know, the ban on trail hunting seems a little bit overkill, excuse the pun, but the problem is that these dogs are trained on animal-scented rags to chase them. And ultimately, we've got a ban on XL bullies being out in public without a muzzle on. I'm really sorry, but if people can't control their dogs not to tear off after foxes because they've been trained on a rag that smells like foxes, they should be on a lead. We wouldn't accept it in the city. We wouldn't accept dogs running off and chasing other animals and tearing them to pieces. It is illegal. So if these people who are doing these trail runs cannot control their dogs, they simply shouldn't be doing them.
Well, I think, look, I've never been out with a hunt. I've never had any desire to. But as I understand it, that most of the people in charge of the hunts are very good at stopping the hounds from doing that. And I'm sure there will always be one or two occasions when you just can't control a pack of hounds, and these things will happen. I think there's a difference between actually deliberately going out intending to actually still hunt a fox and pretending to do a trail hunt than on the odd occasion when it might go wrong.
Listen, I agree with you, but I still don't understand why dogs are being trained on rags that smell of actual animals if there's no intention here. You can have a rag that smells of anything else. It doesn't need to smell of an animal. It just feels very, you know, why are they bothering to train dogs to chase animals and then control them afterwards? Just don't have them get a scent for animals, full stop. Get something else.
Okay, Gabriella, thank you. Let's move on to Philip, who's a new caller in St. Columb Major in Cornwall. Never heard of that one before. Hello, Philip. Hi.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good, thank you.
If you were to ban trail hunting, then what's to stop these hunts going out riding at the weekend, you know, with their dogs? And what's to stop, you know, the dogs may then go and chase a fox. You know, it's whatever we do, they'll find a way around it if they want to do that. Why are we not addressing under an Animal Welfare Act, addressing the welfare of the hounds, you know, making it illegal to put down dogs that are perfectly healthy if they still, you know, have a good chance of life? You know, address the actual impact of the animals. Don't address the, you know, the loophole to the loophole to the loophole where they'll always find a loophole.
Well, I have a bit of sympathy with that, because I think there are many aspects to this animal welfare strategy that the government have published today which are actually quite laudable. So I'm not sort of criticising the whole thing, but I do question as to why this wasn't in the Labour Party manifesto, I don't think. Why have they done this? And it seems to be part of this new strategy, which has been all over the papers over the last week, that they think the way to regain popularity is to pick fights with individual interest groups. Well, I don't think that is the way to win back popularity. You just come across as nasty.
Exactly. I completely and utterly agree. I mean, I think they've lost their way, and if they don't do something quickly to actually regain the public the public's confidence in them, you know, then the next election result is going to be very, very interesting. I have no idea who would be the lead party next time round, as things stand at the moment. I think you mentioned earlier the Labour Party has less support now than the Green Party.
Yep. I mean, I think in the last poll that I saw, the Green Party was on 19%. The Conservatives were up to 22%. Reform were on, I think it was 25%, and Labour were on 14%. I mean, can you believe that? I mean, it's just, that's never happened in any of our lifetimes, that both of the major parties have been sort of down in that area. Philip, thank you very much. Now, Gary thinks he's got the solution. He says there are excellent muzzles that allow dogs to breathe freely when running. Let the hunts continue with massive fines for unmuzzled dogs. Well, I have absolutely no idea whether that might be a potential solution. On the face of it, it sounds perfectly sensible. We'll come to more of your calls in a moment. 0345 6060973. Do you agree with Labour's plans to ban trail hunting? There's going to be a consultation which will start in the new year. And as we heard earlier, the last time that this sort of legislation went through Parliament, it took up 700 hours of parliamentary time. I think it took about 7 years for fox hunting to be banned. Do we really want to waste huge amounts of valuable parliamentary time on this? I would venture to suggest not. You're listening to LBC. I'm Ian Dale. It's 7:31 and Amelia Cox has the news headlines.
The family of Chris Rea have announced his death at the age of 74 with immense sadness. The singer-songwriter, known for his hit Driving Home for Christmas, passed away in hospital earlier following a short illness. A husband has been charged with various sexual offences alongside five other men against his ex-wife in Swindon over a 13-year period. 49-year-old Philip Young is accused of administering a substance to incapacitate Joanne Young, who has waived her right to anonymity. And part of a canal has been blocked off in Shropshire after its banks broke, triggering a major incident. More than 10 people had to be rescued and several narrowboats were left stranded in Whitchurch earlier. LBC weather turning cloudy for most overnight. A few spots of rain developing in western areas. Lows of 4 degrees.
This is LBC.
The big day is almost here and you know what that means. Turkey. Well, not just turkey. M&S British free-range turkey crown with a pork cherry and chestnut stuffing glazed with maple syrup infused with chilli, cinnamon, clove and nutmeg. It also means Cornish cruncher cauliflower cheese with Emmental pecorino and mozzarella. And British baby parsnips with maple syrup glaze with polenta and pecorino. This is not just food. This is M&S Christmas food. Selected stores.
Only 3 days to go until the big day. But you're still running around stores looking for that blouse Mum has at the top of her wish list. There's no such thing as the perfect Christmas, but there are perfect moments. This year, make the most of moments that matter with Coca-Cola. Whether you're trying to track down the perfect gift or chatting with your colleagues about this year's Christmas party, refresh your holiday spirit with Coca-Cola, the perfect drink for sharing in the moment. Coca-Cola, holidays are coming.
Mate, did you know you could win £100 worth of points when you scan your BP Me Rewards card?
Yes.
And that can be spent on M&S or Amazon vouchers?
Yes.
Oh, what would I get? Oh, new shoes for Macy, socks for Dad, a scarf for Mum, bottle of red for
Scan your BP Me Rewards card with every purchase at BP and you could win £100 worth of points every hour. So, don't just scan, scan to win.
What would you get?
Fuel and earplugs.
Offer ends 2nd of January 2026. Participating stores only. T's and C's apply. For details, see bpmerewards.co.uk.
Ian Dale. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
7:33, we're asking whether trail hunting should be banned. That's what Labour plan to do. They're launching a consultation exercise. Nick on Twitter says, on very reliable information with the BHSA, what is the BHSA? British Horses... Chris is going to look that up. I understand circa 10,000 hounds will be destroyed. The Labour government in 2004 allowed the continued breeding of all of hounds for the purpose of trail hunting in good faith. How is destroying 10,000 hounds in the interest of animal welfare? The job losses in the rural communities as a result will be devastating, impacting on farriers, vets, feed merchants and farmers. Stuart says, when the government brought in the fox hunting ban, they said that there was no need to kill horses and hounds because you would still be able to do trail hunting. So it turns out they lied. And then not to do something about religious slaughter is hypocrisy. Oh, don't get me started on that one. I get into terrible trouble when I talk about that. Well, I agree with both of those points, needless to say, if you've heard what I've said over the last half an hour. Let's go to Eddie, who's a first-time caller in Tamworth. Hello, Eddie.
Oh, hi there, Ian. First time I spoke to you, and thank you for taking my call. Ian, this thing about the trail hunting, it doesn't happen. It really is an excuse. If they really did trail hunting, why would there be so many instances of hounds going onto railway lines, running across main roads, going into school playing fields, gardens, churchyards, allotments? You look on social media, the hunt monitors, every week you can see this happening. The trail hunting, it's just is a smokescreen. They're out there, they're going out there to kill animals and to hunt the way that they've always done in their tradition. And Ian, the other thing is, until a couple of weeks ago, most hunts were accompanied by terrier men, guys on quad bikes with a box on the front with a terrier in the box, right? Why on earth would they want to do that if they were trail hunting? I can tell you why. Because when the hounds picked up the scent of a fox and the fox hid in a badger set or a foxhole, the terrier men would be there and they would send the terrier down the hole to flush the fox out so they could carry on hunting it. I've seen it, Ian, and it's terrible. And the hunt saboteurs and monitors are out there every week trying to stop it. But they've abused the hunting fraternity. They've abused. If they were trail hunting, that would be absolutely fine. But they're not. Honestly, Ian, it's just a smokescreen.
Well, look, as I said before to Mike from the League Against Cruel Sports, I'm sure there are some hunts that do this. But are you saying that they all do it, the majority do it, or what?
I'm no longer a hunt saboteur, but I was up to about 3 years ago. And all of the five hunts that I monitored with various groups, they all did it. They all did it. And sometimes there was as many as three or four terrier men masked up with these boxes on the front with the terriers in. Now, I know the governing body recently, and a couple of weeks ago, probably because they're going to be under much more attention and focus now, they said that, oh, no, the hunt shouldn't be taking terrier men out with them any longer. They've been taking them out with them for the last 20 years. Why is that? And if you, well, they've never been able to answer that question, Ian. If you ask the master, say, what's in the box? You know, what's in that box on the front of the quad bike? Why are you
what's in the box.
Well, they got little holes in the front so that they can breathe.
Oh, so they don't just sort of sit there with their legs on the front and looking out then?
No, they're in like an aluminium box, you know, right. with you know, hot holes in. And gosh, you go anywhere near to try and take a photo, and they you know, either get very aggressive or they just, you know, drive off really quickly. It's very, very sensitive because it's what they themselves call their underbelly, because there's no way they could justify it. And the other thing is, Ian, nobody's objecting to them. People going, they could still go and ride, go on, you know, on fun rides around the countryside and, you know, keep all these people in work. No one's objecting to that. That's a nice hobby. Beautiful horses, enjoy the countryside. But they don't have to take, you know, 30 or 40 dogs out and kill wild animals while they're doing it.
I suppose from their point of view, I mean, I was trying to think, what justification could there be for these terriers on the front of quad bikes? And and the only justification I can think of, and it's a pretty weak one, would be to say, well, that's what we always did when we did fox hunting, and it's a tradition, and that we want to maintain the whole spectacle of it with the hounds, with the horses, with the terriers, etc., etc. But I'm not sure that would cut much ice with you, would it?
No, it wouldn't. And come on, I'm trying to be reasonable.
Well, you are being reasonable. I'm just trying to think in my own mind. Well, what is the defence that they could possibly give?
That's why they put out a directive a couple of weeks ago, telling the hunt, saying, "Oh no, you better stop taking the terrier men out with your hunts now, because it's obviously because it's a very hard practice to justify, you know." So, I think the more general point, I don't know, it might have been Gandhi, you will probably know, who said that a nation can often be judged by the way that it sort of treats its animals, you know. And, I would say that. The thing is, it isn't
well, how do you judge a government whose legislation would inevitably lead to the mass slaughter of thousands of hounds?
Well, they haven't got to be mass slaughtered. They can be rehomed. They are pack animals, like the beagles are, the foxhounds are. But, you know, if these people love their dogs so much, you could give them time and subsidies. Oh, we'll give you another year or a couple of years or something to rehome them, you know. But
there's thousands of dogs in dogs' homes that are in need of homes, and yeah, so you're saying have another 1,000. I mean, that's just not practical.
Ian, that's like one of your previous callers.
Yeah, but you seem to care more about the fox than the dog.
Well, the dogs are loved by these hunts, you know, but
exactly.
the foxes are. Well, they will find a solution for it then, won't they? You know, they'll come up with them. I'll tell you something, Ian, don't fall to this thing that Tim Bonner was saying about how they love their hounds. Almost every week, the hunt monitors will find a hound that's been left behind or stuck in a field or a fence somewhere. They're a commodity. They use the hounds as a commodity. They don't love their hounds like, you know, domestic pets. They're just, you know, a tool for them to be used. And they do. There's footage. They do take them out when they can't keep up and they get a bit old and tired. They just take them out and shoot them. So this romantic view about them loving the hounds is another smokescreen.
Well, you're trying to tar everybody with the same brush. I'm sure that there are people that treat them in that way, but I'm sure there are many others that genuinely do love them. Thank you very much. David says, why do you constantly say that banning a trail hunt is against those who live in the countryside? I've ridden horses and I live in a rural area. If you want to ride out with the hounds, they are bloodhound packs that follow a person, and bloodhounds don't kill their animal. Let's go to Adam, who's in St Albans. Adam, hi.
Good evening, Ian. Great speech here.
Hi.
Just on quickly, when the chat before said the situation, nation treats their way the animals, we must always remember the way halal, the way they dispatch their animals on that, which is quite a barbaric way. And
you're absolutely right. And if that was part of this animal welfare package, whether it's halal or kosher, I would be cheering Labour on from the rooftops. But let's not get sidetracked on lies madness.
Absolutely correct, sir, and I take it with you. The connotation of the hunts gathering with the, you know, head huntsman in red is very aristocratic and rich landowner, I feel, with obviously quite a few locals and people can afford horses, and been going on for sort of 200 years. And my view, this is the final nail by the left as a big class war to close down this, if you call sport or activity in the country. It's taken 20, 25 years to push this further, to go there and to really close this down. And I just feel, again, another class war situation. And we've seen many of these going through in the last 18 months to 2 years now with the new Labour in part.
Well, I've only ever been out on one hunt in Norfolk about 20 years ago. And one thing that really struck me on that was the people that were there. And yes, there were people who were fairly wealthy and owned horses, but there were hundreds of people, ordinary working people, who loved the spectacle I mean, who do you think works for the hunt as well? I mean, this is not just sort of an aristocratic pastime. It's something that all classes in this country, and I wish we could even get away from using that word, but people from all sorts of different backgrounds actually have always been part of the hunt.
I agree, and possibly we're seeing a lot more, possibly the city dwellers, I shouldn't use that word too much, but there, it would be interesting to see how many people, country folk, would be against it if there was something to be rallied on that side. It does always seem to be from Leafy, Islington or other places in London. I know that might sound a little bit out of court, but that's how it does feel a little bit that way. And I agree with you, the loss there of industry, it would be quite immense.
Thank you very much indeed, Adam, for phoning in. Stu says, Ian, are you for real? Yes, I am. I'm not some AI presenter here. This is a stupid activity that is carried out by dopey, posh idiots to circumvent the anti-hunting laws. I think we're beyond a bunch of posh toffs, hooray Henrys, gallivanting around the countryside on daddy's horse just to trash and ruin the countryside. I don't really care about foxes. It's the ridiculous and red-coated butlers, idiots chasing them on horses that I hate. Well, that says a lot about you, Stu. I mean, you're a bigot, aren't you, basically? Because you believe that anyone who rides a horse is posh. You could not be more wrong, and I suspect that you've never lived a day of your life in the countryside, have you? Feel free to text me again. It's 7:45.
On the latest episode of The News Agents,
we talk about Turning Point US's annual conference, where MAGA appears to be eating itself. And are we heading back into the EU's customs union?
Get the latest episode of The News Agents with Emily Maitlis, John Sopel and Lewis Goodall. Listen or watch on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
I know every year it's the same. The ones you love most you leave until last. I just struggle to put into words how much you mean to me. Your hugs feel different to everyone else's. Your words hit harder. Your brew tastes better. But how can I say all that?
This Christmas, if you can't find the words, find the gift. John Lewis. Order by 12 p.m. on the 23rd to click and collect from John Lewis and Waitrose stores on Christmas Eve. Terms, conditions and exclusions apply.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard your flight to Geneva. This is your captain speaking, and I would like to take a second to welcome our very special guests. All the skis and snowboards that enjoy a free flight to Winter Wonderland.
The best skiing experiences start with the right airline. Book your winter holiday now on Swiss.com and enjoy free gear transport.
Protect your pets over this festive period. Visit petsinapickle.co.uk and enjoy Christmas covered.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Fanning Dental Group Clinics. Modern, comfortable and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling, and the whole world smiles with you.
Banningdental.co.uk.
This festive season at McDonald's, get
rich deals every day.
Okay, okay. With a sausage sandwich for just...
Let's see, 99p.
Six chicken McNuggets for just...
99p.
Fine. Get Grinch deals every day
in the McDonald's app.
18 plus app only. Ends 24th of December. One use per offer. Fees apply to delivery. Participation varies. T's and C's apply.
Ian Dale on LBC. Text 84850.
7:48. This really does bring out the worst in people, this subject, doesn't it? Roberto, who's a regular email to me, but he only ever emails when he wants to insult me, he says, do you know, if you'd had a radio programme back in the mid-19th century when the abolitionists were fighting against slavery, I'm quite convinced that you would have been on the side of the slavers. You're always with the money. I mean, what would even provoke someone to even think that, given that I've said that I am in favour of banning fox hunting? I mean, it's ludicrous. Here's another one from Jess. I know you won't read this out, but now that I know you said you've been on a hunt, I think you're even more of a despicable man. Well, I didn't say a bit... Well, if I did say it, I expressed it wrongly. I haven't been on a hunt. I went to see a hunt off. That's very different from being on a hunt. I was standing there observing as they did their tooting and off they went. That was all. It's the sort of thing you have to do as a political candidate in a rural seat. I will admit, to my immortal shame, that in the selection meeting for that constituency, I was asked, they said, now we know you're a friend of Anne Widdecombe, do you support her views on fox hunting? Because she has always been against. And I didn't actually lie, but I said, well, I don't agree with Anne Widdecombe on everything, and then just moved on. But I've never been in favour of fox hunting. I grew up on a farm where the local hunt would regularly just trample over my father's crops without any thought at all for the damage that they were doing. The hounds would run throughout our garden, which my mother had carefully tended, and they caused absolute havoc. And I remember saying to my father, when I was probably about 10 years old, I said, when I take over the farm from you, I'm going to ban them from doing this. So don't think that I have any truck with hunts at all, because I don't really. But I do think the ban on trail hunting is utterly preposterous. Let's go to Dave, who's in Portsmouth. Hello, Dave.
Good evening, Ian. Thank you for having me on. I'm clearly on the side of banning the trail hunting because it is completely a smokescreen. And I say that because if you strip it back to what hunting is, basically you've got a chase going on. When you had fox hunting, you had the fox somewhere ahead of dogs that were bred to chase slowly but with a lot of endurance, followed by the huntsmen trying to keep an eye on the dogs, and then the field riders trying to keep up with huntsmen and follow them where they're going. And you could do away with so much of that, and they could still have their chase, if you like, by setting off a horse rider. They don't need to have a trail for dogs to follow. They don't need dogs there at all. They could just follow a rider, give a rider 2 or 3 minute head start, and then pursue them. And they know pretty much where they're going to go anyway, because the routes are already predefined as to where they're going to hunt and what they know where foxes were, so they would previously go and flush out foxes. So none of that would change, and they could still have their jolly good gallop across lots of the private land that they have access to. That would still provide the spectacle for the field supporters that you're talking about having their need for social activity and needing to get out. So you'd still see that spectacle. And there's a lot of scaremongering being said about 10,000 hounds being put down and the effect on the employment. With the hounds, they could stop breeding them and let them die off naturally over the course of years. And it's not as though we're going to have to continue manufacturing the hunt hounds. You know, we don't continue to manufacture VHF tape recorders.
Do you know how much it costs to keep a pack of hounds?
An awful lot of money.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, there's a cost saving right there. And I'm saying, you know, you could actually let them, you know, die out over the period of the years. They don't live for that long. As an earlier caller said, as soon as they're...
And how would you pay for their upkeep? Because you wouldn't have any income, because there wouldn't be a hunt.
Well, they're very well... They could still pay to ride. They could still pay to have the pleasure of galloping across the fields. They don't need to be following hounds. And it's already been said the hounds could possibly be muzzled. They don't need the hounds there. They could be having the same gallop after a person on a horse. So you just stop breeding them and let them out. Even the quad bike riders could go and have their quad bike races round the fields or whatever. Much of the land is owned by the hunt masters. I know in my particular area in Portsmouth,
yeah, no, you're 16, right.
16 farms were owned by the masters of the hunt, and they would tell the farmers that the hunt was coming. Very often the farmers wouldn't want the hunt on their land. Very often it was the farmers that would provide information to the hunt sabs because they didn't want the hunt on their land. Mm. And you've already alluded to the fact that your dad's garden was trampled by it. So, you know, they do ride roughshod across the lands, and most of which they own themselves, and they behave in such a way.
Do you not think, though, that if the motivation really was animal welfare here, and I genuinely doubt that, but if it was, why aren't they banning pheasant shooting? Why aren't they banning rabbit shooting? Why aren't they banning hare coursing?
I would ban all of them as well. Yeah, I wouldn't draw the line at just stopping the fox hunting. All of those other pursuits, you could shoot clays. You don't have to have animals involved in any.
Well, to be fair, if you're shooting pheasants and rabbits, they are food that can be eaten, which is not the same as foxes, obviously. So, I mean, there is a bit of a different justification
for
that.
But again, we don't have to breed pheasants in order to eat them. We don't have to breed pheasants at all. There's plenty of other food sources.
Yeah, with rabbits, I mean, they are a pest. They eat the crops. So, I mean, there is another justification for that. I mean, I will admit, when I was in my teens, I would go rabbit shooting at night with my dad. I'd sit on the front of his pickup truck and pick off rabbits with a 12-bore shotgun.
Which is rather a long leap from 32 dogs and...
Well, no, I accept that, but you get the logic of what I'm saying, though. If your genuine concern is animal welfare, all of these pursuits, you should be campaigning for them to be banned as well.
Yeah, and fishing. Yeah. But you can't say, well, we can't ban trail hunting because we have justifications for continuing shooting rabbits. We have to take each issue on its own merits. There is no merit for hunting with dogs, trail hunting with dogs, because we've already established that it is a smokescreen. It's been shown in court that the hunt can't be trusted to operate within the legislation. They've had their chance to prove it. There's been, how many did you say, 700-odd cases in court in the time that the Act came in? So it shows that
I think the guy from the League Against Cruel Sports said that. Dave, thank you very much indeed. I think I mentioned hair coursing. I think that is actually already illegal. Several of you are saying that. I think it was done in the original Fox Hunting Abolition Act or whatever it was called. Lucy's in Birmingham. Hi, Lucy.
Hello. I want to say if this act is passed, I'm going to vote Labour.
Well, you're easily persuaded.
Yes, it's an important, we could develop that topic, but I'll stay focused. We need to ban this sport in line with other countries which are removing the culture in Portugal and, where is it, Mexico, when they're banning bullfighting, because they're... The animal is, it's not a fair fight. And I believe when a hunt is going out, people will close the den of the fox. So if it manages to get home, that is where it will be killed because it can't escape.
I mean, some people might say, Lucy, that living in Birmingham, you might not understand the traditions of the countryside.
Well, in my
obviously,
youth,
I wouldn't.
I was an animal activist, and I love foxes, and I adore pigeons. Some of the most maligned creatures we've got here.
Well, look, foxes are generally very beautiful animals. I completely agree with that. But in the countryside, I mean, I grew up on a farm, and the number of times that a fox would get in the chicken coop and kill all my mum's chickens, you can understand why farmers don't like them very much.
Well, it's a case of protecting your chickens and making it fox-proof, isn't it?
It's almost impossible, as we found. It's a horrible sight, actually, when you look at the results of a fox getting in a chicken coop.
May I say what a valuable contribution it was from the gentleman who was a hunt saboteur. I enjoyed listening to him and his contribution.
I'm sure you did. Thank you very much indeed, Lucy, for your call. Quickly to Jimmy in Torquay. Hello, Jimmy.
Hello, Derry, and Merry Christmas, mate.
And you.
Yay, I haven't spoke to you since you had Dave Ward on ages ago. Basically, I'm a delivery driver and I've got the privilege of delivering to one of our national parks. And I can totally turn around and say to your Countryside Alliance guy that hunting is definitely a business. On estates, I often see helicopters parked up so that they can go and shoot birds out of the road. And... the road itself, you know, some of our main roads are absolutely laminated with pheasants. So, like, you know, I think it's absolutely pointless.
Well, that's because they've been killed by cars, not guns.
But they should be kept, you know, within certain areas. They shouldn't be allowed onto the roads, you know. And this comes down to the pheasants.
Well, how can you stop a pheasant going? I mean, seriously, I mean, that is the weakest argument of the last hour. You try and cooping a pheasant in doesn't really work. Jimmy, thank you very much. Right, coming up in the next hour, we're going to turn to something that Tom Swarbrick mentioned on his show. He interviewed Larry Lamb, late of this parish. And Larry Lamb has been banging on about why are we all so rubbish at foreign languages? Present company accepted. I do speak one foreign language, a little bit of a second one. But why is it that so many British people don't feel the need to speak a language? And why is it that successive governments from both parties have basically ruined foreign language teaching in this country? Now, it's all very well to say, oh, yeah, but they all speak English in the rest of the world. Yeah, but think of the effect that it has if you actually try and utter some words of a different language. People are quite impressed by that. So why don't we do it more?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 8 o'clock, Chris Rea has died at the age of 74. The singer, who's best known for driving home for Christmas, was surrounded by his family when he passed away in hospital. They've described their loss as immense. He wrote his festive hit from the passenger seat of a Mini on the M1 while banned from driving.
I was feeling silly, and that happens to all of us. On the 1st of December, it's like we all take a pill, and suddenly we want coal fires. Suddenly we want it to snow, and that's what that song is.
A man is due in court charged with repeatedly drugging and sexually assaulting his then-wife in Swindon. A number of other men are also charged with sexually assaulting Joanne Young, who's waived her right to anonymity.
The offences 49-year-old Philip Young is charged with include multiple counts of rape, administering a substance with intent to stupefy, and possession of extreme images. Five other men have also been charged for sexual offences against Joanne over a 13-year period between 2010 and 2023.
LBC's Thea Rickard there. Downing Street insists the Prime Minister is very happy with his cabinet following renewed claims Wes Streeting is vying for the Labour leadership. The accusations by the Tories come after he suggested the UK could join a customs union with the EU, despite the Prime Minister ruling it out. Wes Streeting has previously denied wanting to remove Keir Starmer. Engineers have blocked off a canal in Shropshire after its banks collapsed, flooding the land surrounding it. 10 people were helped to safety in Whitchurch when it happened early this morning, causing a number of narrow boats to get stranded. And the government claims an app coming next year that gives users fuel prices in real time should help drive down prices. The competition watchdog says drivers are still paying too much, calling retailers' profits persistently high. In the city, the FTSE 100 has closed down 31 points at 98.65. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.14. LBC weather turning cloudy for most overnight. A few spots of rain developing in western areas. Lows of 4. A murky day tomorrow with some light rain in the west. Some brighter spells for western areas too. Breezy in the south and east, and highs of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Katie Dartford.
This is LBC from Global. Leading Britain's conversation with Ian Dale.
Very good evening. 3 minutes past 8 is the time on LBC. Right, we're going to talk about languages in this hour. And I have one simple aim. I want to encourage anyone to phone in who's learnt another language, who speaks another language, and I want them to tell me, I want you to tell me, what you get out of it. How difficult was it? And what was the moment when the penny dropped that you're actually quite good at it? I'll tell you what happened to me in a little bit later. Because I think it is a crying shame that so few people now in this country even learn a language to GCSE or A-level. The number of language courses offered at universities in this country is at an all-time low. The number of people studying languages at all is at an all-time low. There used to be loads of evening courses in high schools all around the country, which would offer adults the chance to learn languages, which maybe they didn't learn at school. I wonder how popular they are nowadays, because we know that virtually every other country around the world, English is their second language. So there doesn't seem to be any incentive on us to learn other people's languages. I think that is an absolute crying shame. I think successive governments have not done younger generations a favour by effectively saying, no, there are plenty of other subjects you can study. And even then, it's still just French, German, and possibly Spanish, which are routinely offered up to the age of 14, not 16, 14 now. There is no requirement to learn a language GCSE at that level. And I think that's just wrong. Now, then you can respond and say, oh yeah, but what would you take out of the curriculum to put languages back in? Well, I can't answer that just off the top of my head here. But I just think it narrows people's horizons. It makes them less interested in the rest of the world if they think that they can just get by speaking English. Now, there are countries in the world where even the many locals don't speak English. But and the trouble is that if you go to Europe nowadays, you make an attempt to speak a few words of the local language, and they then work out that you're English, and then they reply in English, which is very, very frustrating. I remember going to Amsterdam once, and I've always wanted to learn Dutch because I think it's a fascinating language, and I speak German, I speak English, so I can understand a bit of Dutch. And I would sort of try and say the odd word, and they would always reply in English. And I always think that's actually quite insulting. And I would never do that here. If I knew someone was German, I wouldn't then automatically, if I met them in a pub or something, I wouldn't then automatically try and speak German to them. So, have you learnt a foreign language? What have you got out of it? And how would you encourage other people to learn that language? And which languages should we be speaking or teaching in schools? I would say that it possibly shouldn't be French and German. I think it should probably be Spanish, Arabic and Mandarin, because those are the languages that will get you much further in life in the future. And then, of course, people say, well, why do we need to learn languages? We've got all these translation apps. We've got Google Translate. We've got AI that is going to transform everything. So what's the point? Well, if you take that attitude, what's the point of learning anything? 0345 6060 973. Well, earlier this evening, Tom Swarbrick spoke to Larry Lamb, used to be an LBC presenter, you may remember back in the day, who outlined his own experiences of learning languages when he was at school.
I went to an old-fashioned grammar school where you did an hour of French every day of the week for 6 years, and you'd have to work hard not to absorb some of it. And I just found I had some sort of a talent for imitating accents, not much of a study in terms of grammar. But over the years, that I gradually picked up a very reasonable command of the language. I went to night school in London and studied German when I was about 20, and then took off on what has become my life and my career, all thanks to the fact that I had a bit of a handle, as you put it, on a couple of languages. And I feel it's absolutely ludicrous that 14-year-old children are considered bright enough and wise enough to be able to decide they're not going to study a foreign language. When I was at school, there were boys and girls in the fifth and sixth form who'd been hanging on and hanging on and hanging on because they couldn't get into a university without one GCSE in a foreign language. Mm. And that's been scrapped. It's crazy. Because the kids, sometimes you don't get the right teacher. It's the luck of the draw, but it's just depriving yourself of a whole potential section of your future if you don't study a language.
Be honest, though, Larry.
14 years old making a decision like that?
But be honest, 14-year-old you presented with the choice of carrying on learning French or not probably would have said no too.
No, absolutely not. I wouldn't.
You'd have carried on.
No way.
You loved it.
Pardon?
you'd have carried on doing it. You liked learning French.
I did it until I left school.
But there are a lot of 14-year-olds who really, really don't like learning these foreign languages. They find it very difficult. It's a waste of time.
Well, stop right there, Tom. They find it very difficult. Uh-huh. Well, you know, that's possibly one of the reasons that they're not being taught properly. Or perhaps they're not being encouraged to even think positively about what the outcome might be. It's like closing off the horizon. It's crazy just to say that you don't do it, or you have the right not to do it. You don't have the right to drop 1 hour of religious knowledge every week.
Do you think this sums up a kind of little Englander mindset?
I think that's got something to do with it. Yes, very definitely. And, you know, people talk about me being a linguist. I'm not a linguist. I can speak one language quite well. I can handle myself reasonably well in another. And I can get by in two more. Well, the minute you tell anybody that, you're a linguist. Yeah, I've never claimed to be a linguist.
I would say that you absolutely are, Larry. Did you say you took yourself off to night school to learn German?
Yeah. Because I was working, this was after I'd left school, I was working for a company that had a business in Germany. I already knew how to speak basic schoolboy French, and I knew this company I worked for had this business over there. And I thought, well, if I went and studied German, maybe there's a chance I could get a job out of this country, go and work away, which is what I wanted to do. And that was the beginning of the reason I am here talking to you today.
Larry Lamb, who I have to say is one of the nicest people I've ever worked with at LBC, he's also argued that it'll mainly be students at state schools who will stop studying languages at 14, while privately educated children are likely to be encouraged by their parents and teachers to carry on with their language studies. And so Larry feels this will only widen inequality between state and privately educated peoples. Well, he's got a point, hasn't he? Professor Suzanne Graham joins me, Professor of Language and Education at the University of Reading, who's also a former secondary school French and German teacher. Suzanne, welcome. This is a bit of a hobby horse of mine, because German was about the only thing that I was ever good at school, and I studied it at university. But even my old university, which is the, I think I'm right in saying, is the furthest east in the country, UEA in Norwich, in 2004, they abolished their language department. You think, well, they had a whole department for Scandinavian languages, German, French, call it what you will. And it's gone now. And all the people of new generations aren't going to have the same opportunities that I had. And I think if this is trickling down to schools now, which it is, that is a crying shame, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it is a shame. I mean, I think the situation is quite complicated. I thought that Larry Lamb said some really interesting things in his comments there that might give a hint to what's going on. So Larry mentioned that he did an hour of French a day. That's considerably more than learners get these days. If they're lucky, they'll get an hour and a half to 2 hours a week. So to be motivated for any subject, to continue with it beyond 14, you need to feel successful at it. And I would argue that that's really difficult to do on an hour and a half a week. So I think to motivate learners so that they want to continue, we have to increase the amount of language teaching per week in school. I think the second thing is that learners need to value languages. And I think that increasingly that's made much more difficult these days, because there is quite a lot of negativity in the media and in political discourse sometimes about multilingualism. Our own research suggests that being surrounded by people with positive attitudes towards German, in the case of the research we carried out, encourages learners to take it for GCSE. So I think schools and parents and everyone really has got a lot to do to promote the value of language learning. And I think actually it's important that learners do feel that they have a choice. We do know that to be motivated, you have to feel you have a choice in something. So I'm personally not that keen on the idea of forcing learners to take a language beyond GCSE. I don't think that's the answer, but there's lots of other things that we can do to encourage more language learning uptake.
Well, it would help if the government started to actually say something positive about language learning in schools, because for 20, 25 years, possibly longer, successive governments have done exactly the opposite, which means it's incredibly difficult now to fulfil posts for to find German teachers, I think. I think French is possibly a lot easier. But then again, are we actually offering the right languages in schools?
I think those two things are possibly related. So I think the recent announcement that the government is introducing or thinking of introducing a different kind of qualification that will allow learners to continue learning a language up to GCSE and beyond, and for which they will get regular accreditation, will encourage more positive attitudes towards language learning. And it will also open up the doorway to different languages. So you're right that just offering French, German, Spanish at GCSE probably isn't a good idea. So this alternative accreditation that's been put out there for possible consideration would allow learners to learn all sorts of different languages, including heritage languages that they might already speak at home. I mean, I think if you're talking about things like Mandarin, again, you come up against the issue of teaching time. So Mandarin is a difficult language. You certainly can't learn it on an hour and a half a week. And it's interesting to think that the Mandarin Excellence Program, which has been very successful in schools, gets considerably more teaching time than an hour and a half a week. So I think we have to be, you know, we have to really understand that to be successful at language learning, you have to spend a lot of time doing it. And that means a lot of the curriculum, much more than is presently the case, has got to be devoted to language learning.
What got you interested in languages in the first place? Was it something you just discovered you had an aptitude for?
I think I found them really interesting. I think I did feel I was good at them. They weren't the only things that was true of, but I think I really enjoyed learning about other cultures. I think that's something we could offer young people more of, rather than just the nuts and bolts of grammar. I think I was interested in finding out about how people live and think in other countries. So yes, a combination of all those things.
Because I think what did it for me was when I went on two school exchange visits to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I was bottom of the class before I went on these, and then I came back and we did the end of year exams, and suddenly I was top of the class.
Yeah.
My teacher thought I'd cheated, I think, which I genuinely hadn't.
Yeah.
And then a few months after that, I remember he asked me a question in German. I responded in German, and he said, "Why did you say it like that?" And I said, "I don't know." And he said, "Well, that's great. That's the first sign mm-hmm. of fluency."
Yeah.
And that did something for my self-confidence, and I just became obsessed with it. And I suppose that everybody, we all have subjects that we love, we have subjects that we hate. But just going on those school exchanges, that sort of triggered something in my brain, I think. And I worry that those sorts of school trips now aren't happening to the extent that they used to.
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think the ability to communicate with a real person in the country of the language that you're learning is a really important motivator. And it is a pity that those trips don't happen as much as they did for various reasons. I mean, I think it is possible to give learners insights into the culture through other means. Perhaps, I mean, I think, you know, the internet at least has that advantage in terms of language learning. But I agree that making contact with real people who speak the language is a really important motivator.
And do you think AI is going to kill language teaching or actually aid it?
I think if used properly, it's a bonus. I think it's really important that we retain the human element. AI can't be beneficial without a teacher. But it does open up many more opportunities to practice and become more proficient. And so it enables all the things that I talked about earlier in terms of increasing the amount of practice time, which is essential for actually becoming competent in language learning.
Suzanne, thank you very much indeed. That's Professor Suzanne Graham from the University of Reading. Lots of people calling in. Remember, I want to know how you got into learning languages, what you get out of it, and what can you do to persuade other listeners who have never had any interest in learning a language to actually think about the benefits of doing so. It's 18 minutes past 8.
LBC. LBC.
The big day is almost here, and you know what that means. Turkey. Well, not just turkey. M&S British free-range turkey crown with a pork, cherry and chestnut stuffing glazed with maple syrup infused with chilli, cinnamon, clove and nutmeg. It also means Cornish cruncher cauliflower cheese with Emmental pecorino and mozzarella. And British baby parsnips with maple syrup glaze with polenta and pecorino. This is not just food. This is M&S Christmas food. Selected stores.
Only 3 days to go until the big day. But you're busy endlessly scrolling for the gift your auntie wants that no store seems to have. There's no such thing as the perfect Christmas, but there are perfect moments. This year, make the most of moments that matter with Coca-Cola. Whether you're trying to track down the perfect gift or chatting with your colleagues about this year's Christmas party, refresh your holiday spirit with Coca-Cola, the perfect drink for sharing in the moment. Coca-Cola, holidays are coming.
When you go abroad, everyone knows the best way to make yourself understood is to just say everything in English, but louder.
Four beers, please, garçon!
If only there was a way that could work with your advertising campaign. Well, there is. And you're listening to it. Because when you amplify your advertising with radio, 40 million listeners every week get the message. See radio differently at radiocentre.org.
This is LBC with Ian Dale. Call 0345 6060973.
20 past 8. Zotz says, we don't learn other languages as we're a closed-off country of sad little Englanders who expect everyone else to speak English when abroad but don't have the pride to try ourselves. I don't think that's true. I thought you were going to mention the B word there. Some people say, oh, this is the inevitable result of Brexit. Well, let me break it to you that this has been going on for 25, 30 years. I don't think Brexit's helped in terms of encouraging language learning. But it is true that a lot of other countries, English is their second language. They pick it up very quickly. English is an easier language to learn than quite a few others. But I don't think it's got anything to do with being little Englanders, because as a nation, not just recently, but throughout the centuries, I mean, we've always been an outward-looking nation, and I think we still are. Let's go to Lauren in Tooting. Hello, Lauren.
Evening.
Hi. What would you like to say?
Well, I went from Glasgow to Saudi Arabia, and we had to learn to speak. We went to classes twice a week to learn basic Arabic, because we had to speak to the patients.
And how difficult was that? Because I imagine, I don't know, but I imagine Arabic is a pretty difficult language for English speakers to learn.
Well, they taught you the basics, but because I've got a Scottish accent, the H in the Scottish and the H of the Arabic is very similar.
I'm just trying to imagine Arabic spoken with a Scottish accent.
A Glasgow accent.
It's like if I speak French, because I speak German, I speak French with a German accent, not an English accent, which I've never quite understood why that is. But whenever I go to France and utter the odd word or sentence or two in French, they always think I'm from Germany.
Mm. I came back to London, and who did I look after? Arabs.
Because of that experience?
Yes. And if I see Arab women in London, because I live in London, I say hello to them, how are you? You shouldn't be. And they love it. They love it that you're speaking their language.
And that, in a sense, I mean, I can hear by the tone of your voice and how you sound that you really get a lot out of that.
Yes, because we always automatically think that they should speak English, and they speak English excellently.
Yeah.
But the fact that you're trying, it's the same when you go to France, Spain, Greek. If you try, they'll think, well, at least, and you get better service. You get better service. But it's true.
It absolutely is. I went to Sweden a few weekends ago, and in Stockholm, literally everybody speaks English.
Beautifully.
Perfectly, almost. And I don't speak any Swedish. I know about sort of please and thank you, and that's about it. And I did feel very inadequate in not being able to speak anything beyond the basic rudiments.
But anyway, we could talk French in school, but we weren't taught proper French. It was open the door and shut the door.
Fermez la grande bouche.
Fermez la bouche. And a few swear words.
Yeah, well, you want to know those in any language, don't you? Lauren, thank you. Actually, a funny story. I can't use the word, but when my German pen friend, this was in 1977, Frank came to visit us, he taught my sisters some very naughty words. And just at lunch one day in front of my parents, one of my sisters asked him a question, basically in English, but using the German word. And of course, he naturally assumed that my parents would understand what it was. And it was a very, very bad word. You had to be there, I guess. Let's go to Scott, who's a first time caller in Barron's Court. Scott, hello.
Hi, Ian.
Hi, what would you like to say?
Well, I was just going to answer your question, really, about, you know, what would I say to persuade people to learn languages? I mean, I like you, I did German at university. I did German and French, so I can speak those pretty well. I can get by in Spanish, and I work in Holland quite a lot, so I can speak a fair bit of Dutch. And so the first thing is that as soon as you learn one language, the next language is a little easier to learn. And then the next one is a little easier to learn, particularly, obviously, if they're related, like English, yeah. German and Dutch. But the real key to it, someone once said to me, was if you go to another country and expect them to speak English, very often they will be able to, but you will be experiencing their world in black and white. And actually, if you can just go into their language, you'll experience their world in colour, because you will never, ever get a handle on exactly how they live, exactly how they socialise, if you're constantly expecting them to shift into your language.
Exactly.
So I think it's so important, not only, I mean, apart from anything else, you know, obviously, like you, I went and spent time in Germany and in France when I was young, when I was a student. You also learn a few things about how they do things that are a bit better than how we do things here. And you think, well, hang on a minute, if only we did that, you know, if only we ran our trains like they did in Germany back in the day, or you know.
Not any longer, apparently.
No, it's gone downhill terribly. I was there the other week, and they've got a reputation now that they're worse than British trains, which is obviously incredibly damning. But no, it was. I have to say that, you know, the first time I ever sort of turned round, either in Germany or France, as a young man, and sort of looked up at a poster and understood it, or heard an announcement on the train and just understood it without trying to translate it in my head. These are like amazing eureka moments that, you know, you and I will know how golden that is. But I just recommend that everyone gives it a go. You can't lose anything by learning a language. You can only gain. And also, I'm told, it's very good for you cognitively and, you know, perhaps staves off dementia.
Oh, it absolutely is. That's why I always thought when I sort of retire, in inverted commas, which I can't really imagine ever doing, but if I did, that's when I thought I would learn Dutch properly. Because I bought, when I was at university, I bought this cassette tape thing called Levend Nederlands, and it was just a way to learn it. And I started it, and I thought, I'm never going to be able to devote the time to this, so I stopped it, and I thought, no, I'll do that when I retire. But, of course, the best time to learn languages is actually the age of 7. And isn't it strange that in primary schools, I don't know if it's different now, but certainly I think we did a little bit of French in our final year at primary school. And then of course you move to secondary school and you have three or four lessons in it each week. But yeah. 7 years old is the ideal time to learn a new language.
But I can also tell you, I only learned Dutch, 2 years ago. I'm 56. So I learned Dutch 2 years ago because I was going to Holland quite a lot. And I thought, I'm going to give it a go, you know, because this is silly just speaking English, even though they speak perfect English. Mm. And because I speak German and because I speak English, you can sit online and just work it out, to be honest. You can practice it, and eventually you can work out the template that gets you from English and German into Dutch. And actually, even though they don't need me to speak Dutch there, if I'm at a conference or something like that, and there's just a coffee break in the middle of some sessions and people are standing around chatting in Dutch, I can now join them instead of them having to switch. Yeah. And these things are currency, you know. People people warm to you a little bit, even if it's subconsciously, because you can speak their language.
And you don't have to speak it perfectly. The fact that you've made an effort, and I think particularly the business environment, actually does count for an awful lot.
Absolutely, yeah, exactly. Make mistakes, you know, they don't mind. They'd rather hear you making mistakes and having a go. The only thing about, obviously, the Netherlands is that if you're really basic, they get bored and impatient. So you have to reach a point where you can actually hold a very basic conversation so that it's worth them working with you, because otherwise they'll just flip to English because it's much more efficient for them to do so and no great effort. But it doesn't take much. English and Dutch are very closely related. And once you work out, you know, the equivalence between them, the cognates, the words that are the same words spelt differently, you can learn Dutch pretty quickly as an English native speaker.
And of course, you will make mistakes, which can be very, very funny. I always remember one of my friends said to one of the teachers in the German school that we were going to, it was a very hot day, and he said, "Oh, ich bin so heiß."
Ah, well, we know what that means, really.
Well, you and I do, but our listeners won't, not necessarily they won't do. If you say I am hot in German, it basically means I'm horny.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is not what you want to say to your 65-year-old German teacher.
No, not really. But you know what? You make that mistake once and you learn. Then you won't make it again.
You certainly do. Scott, thank you very much indeed. I say a friend of mine said that. It was me. Okay, I admit it. Right, this is from Dale, who says, shouldn't we be teaching home languages too? The amount of people who don't know, this is not from Dale, it's from DAFZ, D-A-F-Z, never heard of that one before. Shouldn't we be learning home languages too? The amount of people who don't know Welsh is a language by itself is shocking, let alone Gaelic, Scots, Manx. Oh, I thought you meant Manchester. I didn't know there was a separate language in Manchester. You mean Manx, as in Isle of Man, Cornish, etc. I am Welsh first language, English second, and know basic French and some Polish for work, and some Swahili, and some Spanish. Knowing languages early made me pick up other languages more easily. That is a real problem, isn't it? Because if you look at Welsh as an example, where you go to Wales, all the road signs are in English and Welsh, and yet a comparatively small number of people actually do speak Welsh as a first language, and it's mainly in the north rather than the south. But I think you do have to learn Welsh in schools now. I think that was introduced comparatively recently. So maybe Welsh will experience a bit of a revival. You look at Irish, which is really on the increase in the Republic of Ireland. So lots and if you're a politician in Ireland and you don't speak Irish or Gaelic or whatever you want to call it, then you're less likely to get on, I think. It's got to that point. And I would love to see all of these languages revived because they are important. They're part of our history. They're part of our heritage. And the more people speak them, the better, as far as I'm concerned. Right, we'll take more of your calls. What inspired you to learn a language and what do you get out of it? And how can you persuade other listeners, maybe in the new year, to sign up for a language course at their local adult education centre? It's 8:31, news headlines on LBC with Katie Dartford.
Chris Rea, whose songs include the hit Driving Home for Christmas, has died at the age of 74. A spokesperson from his family says he passed away earlier today following a short illness. A man has been charged with drugging and raping his ex-wife over a period of 13 years. Five other men are also accused of assaulting Joanne Young, who has waived her right to anonymity. Wes Streeting has downplayed renewed claims that he's looking to replace Sir Keir Starmer as Labour leader. The Health Secretary has suggested the UK could join a customs union with the EU, despite the Prime Minister ruling it out previously. LBC weather turning cloudy for most overnight. A few spots of rain developing in western areas, lows of 4 degrees.
LBC.
Only 3 days to go until the big day, but you're still running around stores looking for that blouse Mum has at the top of her wish list. There's no such thing as the perfect Christmas, but there are perfect moments. This year, make the most of moments that matter with Coca-Cola, whether you're trying to track down the perfect gift or chatting with your colleagues about this year's Christmas party. Refresh your holiday spirit with Coca-Cola, the perfect drink for sharing in the moment. Coca-Cola, holidays are coming.
Aldi's Christmas Super 6 Fruit and Veg. Top of the tree for freshness, quality and price. At just 5 pence each, white potatoes, carrots, parsnips, Brussels sprouts, cabbage and swede, all British. In store this week. Aldi, multiple fruit and veg retailer 2025 at the FPC Fresh Awards. Products and prices may vary, subject to availability.
Same.
Ho, ho, ho!
Same.
3, 2, 1, hey!
Same.
Whoa, thanks.
Same.
What does Santa call his dog?
Same. Same.
One word. Free syllables.
Same. Same.
Sorry, it's a bit dry.
New plates.
Ooh. Ooh.
Treat your table to something different this Christmas. Visit your local IKEA now. IKEA, the wonderful everyday.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
Ian Dale. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
8:34. The pleasing thing whenever we talk about foreign languages in this country, it's something that always attracts a huge number of calls, which indicates to me that there is still a real interest in learning a language. And I think a lot of the technology that we have nowadays, I mean, when you compare it to when I went to school, we did have a language lab where you could sit there with headphones on and you would learn from the tapes that they played. It's very different now. I mean, you've got Google Translate, and you might think, well, that means we don't have to learn a language. No, it's a great aid to learning a language, though. I use it quite often in all sorts of different languages, and it means that I learn new words in those languages as I'm using it. So, look, everything is a learning experience, isn't it? Aaron is a new caller in Norwich. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, Ian.
Hi, what would you like to say?
Well, I was sent to you a researcher. I've got a daughter who originally started Mandarin in middle school.
Wow.
And lo and behold, the teacher left, moved to the high school she now attends, and she was really pleased to sort of end up with the same teacher, and she's really become really proficient, and she's doing that well. They're talking about sending her to either an exchange trip in Beijing or to a private school in our area, which would be fantastic, obviously.
I mean, that would be life-changing, probably.
There's so many benefits for it. I mean, in the future, she's looking to go into law, and then she'd tie in, obviously, the Chinese language with it. But it opens so many doors, and the language she's learning, which then she's picking bits of Japanese up, she's picking bits of Korean up. There's evidence to suggest that sort of it helps ward off dementia. I think one of your previous callers mentioned there's so many benefits to it. And I think we're so lazy and fickle in this country where we sort of just expect everyone else to speak English and sort of muddle along because it's so widely spoken, rather than sort of picking up another language for ourselves, really.
Well, I think people should be learning Norfolk.
So some of us have got a proper twang, I suppose, haven't we, Ian?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what, because I sold my house in Norfolk a year ago, and I so miss hearing Norfolk accents, and I always found that when I would spend any time in Norfolk, it's a bit like in Australia where at the end of the sentences your voice goes up a bit, doesn't it? And I really miss that, and I would find myself doing it, not deliberately, it was just sort of, you become acclimatised, and it is, obviously it's an accent rather than a language, but it's a great accent.
I don't notice mine myself, but a lot of people have said it's fairly Norfolk-y, I suppose. But if you go to somewhere like Cromer, that is really sort of twangy.
Hey, got a light boy?
Yeah, exactly that. But yeah, obviously with the language as well. I mean, when as you're younger, I mean, it's easy to pick it up. But like with my daughter, her situation, the intonation and the dialect and stuff, and she's actually had teachers say to her, like, if I wasn't looking, it would sound like a Chinese child as such, so...
Well, that is amazing at that age to be so proficient, because normally, to become, I would say, fluent, you have to have spent quite a bit of time in the country. When I lived there for two lots of 9 months, and the second one, I could speak the language so well that no German knew I was English, and I had to actually prove by showing them my passport on a couple of occasions, because they refused to believe that I wasn't German, which, unfortunately, that's no longer the case.
They supposedly say German is 2,000-year-old English, apparently.
Do they? I haven't heard that one before.
That's what my old modern foreign language teacher always told me about Germany. Well, maybe he's wrong, I don't know, but...
Well, I mean, there are similarities, and I think English does, I mean, it does stem from German. You're absolutely right. Aaron, thank you very much. Kath says, I've just visited my German pen friend of 40 years. I took my children with me to stay with her, and her kids have visited us in the summer. They live in an area of South Germany where dialect is spoken. I had to learn their dialect, which I think helped me become fluent. That's Carolyn in Yorkshire. Well, you mix Yorkshire with a bit of Bayerisch or Schwäbisch, that would be an interesting mix to hear. Roz is first-time caller in Arundel. Hello, Roz.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Good, thank you.
So I've been itching to call because I know that a few of your colleagues have touched on this subject recently. So I studied French at school. I wasn't very good at many other subjects, but I had a passion for languages, went on to university, and I was able to choose a new language, so I went for Spanish because I'd done a year at school, and I had a fantastic teacher. So you had to learn it from, they called it ab initio, which in Latin means from scratch. And then within a year, the first summer, I went to Spain as an au pair, and I came back, and I had such fluency. And anyway, I did my degree in PGCE. I didn't go into teaching. That's another story. But then I started working as a bilingual PA, and then they recommended me to work in their Madrid head office. And then after 4 or 5 years working and living in Spain, I just obviously built up this fluency, and it was fantastic. And I came back to London and then managed to bag the best PA job in a UK-based Spanish bank. Well, they're worldwide, actually. And I've never looked back. And the thing I find is when I travel and I'm on holiday in two-thirds of the world, I can communicate in their own tongue. And it's really helpful. And it just it gives you a sense of, you feel liberated. If I ever go to Greece or Turkey, I try and pick up a few words ahead of time, or I manage to absorb what they're saying and have a go. And it's a bit like acting. I'm naturally shy, but when I have to speak a foreign language, I come to life, and it just feels so natural. And I guess it's because I know it's a strength I have. So I would definitely recommend it, as a subject. And even later on, there's so many means with which you can learn. Online learning wasn't such a thing when I was, in my teens and 20s. But now, I'd say, go for it, at any age. It's a lot easier when you're younger, of course, because you absorb information more easily. But just having that facility to communicate when you're traveling.
And what's the biggest faux pas you've committed in Spanish?
Estoy embarazada, which means I wanted to say I'm embarrassed, but that actually means I'm pregnant. Embarazada. So it's quite different. yes, I wouldn't recommend it. There are plenty more, and in French as well. And the thing is, we all have an education at school. I've forgotten half of it, maybe more. But I have never forgotten my languages. Mm. And even if there's a period of time, you probably know this with German, there's a period of time that you don't use it so much, it soon comes back.
Well, I reckon it takes me 2 days to get back into it. If I go to Germany, I'm always really nervous. I remember once I went to, this was in about 2015, and I hadn't seen my sort of what I call my German family for 15 years. And I remember driving up the Autobahn, being really nervous. Well, will I be able to understand them? Will I be able to have a proper conversation? Right. I mean, I used to beat them in Scrabble in German. So, and I remember parking round the corner from their house, having to really steel myself to knock on the door. And of course, as soon as I did, it was just like we'd seen each other like last week. It was fantastic, and I shouldn't have been nervous. Okay. But, I mean, there were a few times when the conversation, when you're searching for a word and it just won't come, and then two or three days later, it's all back.
Yeah, for sure. And I think as well, growing up, we looked forward to things, simple things like, well, not simple, for us it was big, the exchange week that we had. And then you hosted your student pen pal. But now I think where kids are going on holiday more often with mum and dad, you know, they'll have a trip to France and Spain regularly. We didn't do that, so it was a big thing when we did go.
Yeah.
But now I think kids go abroad, they see how people are, you know, English is widely spoken. You know, why bother? They'll just Google stuff. It takes more effort. So I think, unfortunately, it's a bit of laziness as well. But honestly, having a language is so powerful. When I've been on holiday with a partner and I'm like, you know, yapping away to the locals, you know, I feel quite empowered. I really do. So I definitely think, you know, go for it and maintain it. There's loads of ways that you can maintain it. I mean, on my iPhone as well, I have three different keypads. So if I'm sending a message to a friend in France or Spain, I can just, just flip between the three. And
I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah, on your iPhone, you can. You can select.
I should look that up.
Yes. And well, then all the accents are there. And obviously the French clavier, the French keyboard is slightly different, isn't it? It's the AZERTY as opposed to QWERTY.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's all there for you. But it's so nourishing, I think.
Well, I think you have done better than any caller so far to encourage other people of the benefits of learning a foreign language. So thank you for that, Roz. You're exactly the call I wanted to get. Alan says, I love it when you pick these topics out of thin air, Ian. They're always really interesting and get insightful calls. Makes a change from the heated political banter, but then I'm pretty keen on that too. Well, it's in the run-up to Christmas. Look, we're always going to do a few different, slightly off-the-wall subjects. And I love doing that, frankly. I too can get tired of the heated political debate sometimes. Right, we'll take more of your calls in a moment. And if you have got, like I had, like Jane had there, a faux pas that really embarrassed you when you've been trying to speak a foreign language, we would love to hear about it, either on the phones or you can text 84850. It's 8:45.
This is LBC.
Gift more for less when you shop at the O2 this Christmas. Save up to 70% off RRP on over 60 of their favorite designer brands, including Nike, Tommy Hilfiger, Le Creuset, The Cosmetics Company Store, and Lindt. Ticked everyone off your list. Start the festivities at one of our 30 bars and restaurants. Enjoy a movie or get competitive with bowling, climbing, interactive football, indoor skydiving, and more. Find us at North Greenwich, just 15 minutes from central London. Search outlet shopping at the O2 to start planning your visit.
With Lidl Plus, there's no need to stress to impress this Christmas. Get 15% off deluxe chilled party food, like golden prawn toasties with ponzu dip, scrumptious paella bites, and delicious vegetable dim sum. Lidl, more to value. 18 plus GB only, subject to availability. Selected stores, terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/lbtv. Ends 31st of the 12th.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard your flight to Geneva. This is your captain speaking. And I would like to take a second to welcome our very special guests. All the skis and snowboards that enjoy a free flight to Winter Wonderland.
The best skiing experiences start with the right airline. Book your winter holiday now on Swiss.com and enjoy free gear transport.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
When your favourite celebs strut their stuff. When the underdog rises to the occasion. When you can't believe the judges' scores.
Wow, that was fantastic.
Wish I could pass a dough like that.
Well, for starters, you could pass a dough's bickies.
Nothing brings us together like great TV. And a TV licence covers you to watch all TV channels. So you can enjoy every twist and turn of your favourite reality show. Search TV
license
together.
Ian Dale on LBC. Listen on your smart speaker. Just say, play LBC.
8:48 on LBC. Fraser says, what do you think is the best way to learn a new language? Merry Christmas. I've really enjoyed the new podcast with Tessa Dunlop this year. Well, Fraser, thanks for that, because there's a new edition of the podcast out tomorrow. We recorded it this afternoon, and there's quite a lot of hilarity in it, has to be said. So let's go back to some of your call. Oh, no, let me answer your question first. I think nowadays, if you're an adult, so you've been through the school system, and you've decided that you haven't learned the language that you wanted to learn, there are some brilliant online courses out there now. I haven't done one, so I can't recommend which particular one, but there's a huge range in any language that you like. But frankly, the best way to learn a language is to go and stay in the country for a few weeks. You're not going to become fluent after a few weeks, but you will pick up the basics, and that may give you a grounding. I mean, some languages, German is one, where if you understand the grammar, which is what you do learn in school, it's much easier to move on from that. I think German's a language that if you don't know the grammar, you're never going to be particularly fluent in it. But as I say, lots of online languages. And don't forget your local adult education. I know that's been sort of slightly decimated in recent years, but I'm sure most people will find somewhere relatively near them where you can at least learn some of the basic languages. Jane's in Huddersfield. Hello, Jane.
Oh, hi. I wanted to say that the problem with the education system, and I've been in it 40 years nearly, is that we're utterly obsessed with grammar. The nuts and bolts of grammar and not conversation. And I've looked after quite a lot of language assistants that have come over to this country in the past, and they hold their heads in their hands and say, no wonder the Brits can't speak anything, because we're too obsessed with writing, grammar and perfection. So if I give you, you just said it, oh, you've got to know grammar for German. You don't. The Germans don't care if you don't, you get der, die, das wrong. They really don't care. I've got German relatives. They don't care. So in 1986, when I started teacher training, I was sent to the Manor Estate in Sheffield, and Sheffield Manor Estate is a very special place, a truly deprived place. And they dumped the school, and they made it a pilot school, and they had dog handling with the police and all sorts of exciting things. And they dumped the languages, and they turned it into holiday French and holiday Spanish. And those kids could say anything in French and Spanish to do with going places, ordering food, booking a hotel room, because they did role play and they spoke and they did conversation continually. And so when it came to exams, okay, they didn't do fantastic in the exams, but they didn't too bad because they couldn't spell it right. Yeah. Who cares? Yeah. You're never going to do past historic, passé composé, pluperfect, the 13 extra verbs. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. You get it wrong, apart from the Parisians, who do care a bit about it.
You make a brilliant point.
And you speak. You just speak. I mean, I speak Thai, Italian, French, German. I've had to learn Thai because I lived out there. And, you know, if you didn't speak Thai, you couldn't do anything in the 1990s. And, you know, I ended up doing some really special teaching for some incredibly important people in that country because I knew the manners and I could speak some Thai. And when we went out places to places where they'd never seen kids with blonde hair, we went out into the jungle, all sorts of wacky places. I spoke enough Thai, I knew the culture, and we had a fabulous time. But I didn't have to sit there and write different tenses and all the rest of it. Nobody cares. Mm. Truly, nobody cares. If you want to do that, go and do an A-level, except A-level is about literature. You have to learn books. What's that about? We're not learning the language, we're learning writing. And so you're getting rid of all your SEND students, you're telling them that they can't do that language if they're dyslexic because they're struggling with the writing already. But there was nothing wrong with those kids on the Manor Estate. They were absolutely fabulous. I can't describe how good they were. It was absolutely amazing, that pilot school. And then Thatcher came in and then they burned the school down. But hey, you know.
Well, hang on. Hang on. I think you said it was 1986. She was already there.
Yeah, I know, but they put in the national curriculum.
Yeah, that was
big time.
That was 1990,
once the national curriculum went in, that was it. The kids went, well, if we're not doing dog handling anymore, we're not learning the Spanish we want. They used to plan all their lessons. They used to plan the food they're eating with the catering department. It was absolutely, they saw the point of what they were doing.
Mm.
We teach them a language. We teach them things they never need to know. Never need to know.
Yeah, but you can say that about all sorts of subjects, can't you? I mean, you can say that about maths. You can say that about history. Geography.
Yep, absolutely.
Who needs to know what an Oxbow Lake is?
That's what's wrong with the education system. It's 1970s backwards. miles away, and we're not teaching them languages. You speak to any language assistant who comes over, and they can't believe it, because their kids in parts of Germany do not start writing grammar until they're 13. But they've been speaking it for 6 years, and they're pretty fluent, so it's pretty easy, actually, because they know what to say.
Before I let you go, do you want to give us a little bit of Thai?
Okay, put pasatai der magang Thai. I speak Thai, but not very well.
Sounded good to me. Jane, thank you very much. Let's move on to Ram, who is in Wallington. Hello, Ram.
Hello, Ian. Good evening.
Evening.
Guten Abend, Ian.
Schön
Abend. Ian. Ayu Bhavan, Ian. Vanakkam, Ian. And Namaste, Ian. Oh, my God, I can go on.
I can tell.
Oh, my God. Ian, this is my first time I'm talking to you. I've spoken to Nick Ferrari and Clive Bull. As I told you, the lady, young lady and the young man, I have always been interested in foreign languages. I'm from Sri Lanka. I'm going to be 75 in next August. I'm from Sri Lanka. My main language is Tamil. But I started learning English at the age of 8, I guess. And at the age of 11, my father took me to Colombo. Then I learned Sinhala, the national language of Sri Lanka. Then, okay, time moved on. We went to university and we went to Nigeria. I learned the one I said, Eka Sang is Nigerian. And from there, we came to UK in 1984. But prior to that, when I was at university, for the a special degree, they were given the chance to learn a foreign language, either French or German. I missed out by a couple of marks. It frustrated me very, very well. So while I was teaching in Sri Lanka, I went from Kandy, central part of Sri Lanka, to Colombo, 70 miles. Every Friday evening, I learned French and German, came back Sunday evening, and went back to my school. That's my history. Anyway, move on. But then I kept my interest in languages. I learned French and German. And when I went to Prague, when my daughter was studying there, I brushed up some of greeting, especially in Czech language. The taxi driver, when he dropped us, I said thank you to him. I can't remember the Czech. He tapped him on his shoulder. He looked at me strange. My daughter said, Dad, these people are strange. They are not friendly as English people.
Sure, I love your laugh. Tom, I've got a text here about you. Tom says, I would give my left arm to be 1% as happy as this guy.
Oh, God, serious? Bless you, Tom, bless you. Oh, God, I love to learn another language. I'm going to be 75 in next August.
Well, if the length of life is determined by positivity and happiness, you're going to live to 100,
right.
Ram.
You're right, yeah.
And I'm devastated that it's taking you this long to speak to me rather than Nick and Clive. So we want to hear from you again. Thank you very much indeed. Listen, we're going to carry on with this subject for the next hour because we've got so many calls. People are really interested in it. So if you've thought, oh, I won't phone because it's near the end of the hour, I've got two spaces on my switchboard and we'll get you on in the next hour as well. Greg is in Kilmarnock. Hello, Greg.
Hi there.
Hi, what would you like to say?
Yeah, well, I'll give you my first language mishap. First of all, when I was living in Spain, I had to complain to the landlord that the boiler wasn't working, but I got the words for boiler and hip mixed up.
Oh, dear.
So when he said that the boiler was broken, I said to him my hip was broken and almost called an ambulance for me. So that's my mishap.
Yeah, because you wouldn't get a plumber fixing your hip, would you?
Well, basically, I learned very quickly how to say boiler after that, so that was good. But I wanted to call mainly, so I'm actually a languages teacher in Scotland. I teach French and Spanish. I think the biggest issue that I see personally is that we're so exam-focused that we don't actually get a lot of time to teach kids how to speak the language, like a previous caller was saying, for holiday language, for example, you know, role plays and that sort of thing, which are so important. It's so much focused on learning skills to pass the exam, which I think is something we need to really look at. And I think that's probably a similar issue in the English system as well.
That's a really interesting point about role play, because I'm trying to think back to my school days, and I don't think we ever did that as part of language learning at all. It's such an obvious thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, that sort of transactional language, you know, learning how to do the formalities of speaking to someone and, you know, what's the script going to be like when you go to a restaurant and try to book a table, that sort of thing. I think it's really valuable, but unfortunately there's not enough time in the curriculum these days to devote the time to that, because you're judged on your exam results more than anything else. So you've got to get these kids prepared for the exam, which is unfortunate. But when I think about where my languages have taken me, you know, I've lived in Spain, I've lived in France, I've been to China on a school trip, and I can assure you that people in China do not speak English as much as you might think. You know, I had to learn how to say this one, chicken, very, very quickly to get some food, you know, in the canteen that we were in. I was on a cruise recently, a Greek Islands cruise, and because of my Spanish, there were so many Spanish speakers on this cruise, it was made 1,000 times better, all these new Spanish people that I met and was able to communicate with. It really just, it's all part of the human experience, I think.
Absolutely.
Being able to speak another language. And as one of your callers was saying, it doesn't matter if you make mistakes in the language. You know, if someone speaks English and they say something like "an elephant," you know what they're trying to communicate to you, even though they should say "an elephant." You know, it's not really the biggest issue in the world.
No, quite. Listen, Greg, we're going to have to leave it there because we do need to go to the news. But thank you very much indeed for your call. Well, as I said, we're going to continue our conversation on languages. And I particularly want to know if you've started to learn a language later in life. What's the experience been like? I mean, is it more difficult? Because it's always said that it is more difficult to learn a language if you're in your 50s or 60s, or even 70s, rather than when you are at school. But I suspect that you've got more opportunity to actually use it and visit the country whose language you're wanting to speak. Let's have some more of your linguistic faux pas. We've had a couple of corkers so far. And don't worry, I'm not going... No, I won't say it. 0345 6060 972. 9 o'clock.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 9 o'clock, singer-songwriter Chris Rea, the man behind Driving Home for Christmas, has died at the age of 74. He sold millions of records in the 70s and 80s and won Brit Awards. Music journalist Matt Charlton told LBC he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and had his pancreas removed in 2001.
But we hadn't heard much about any other health issues, and this, apparently, as we've just heard, was a short illness. It's just such a strange thing that it so often happens around Christmas time that we lose people associated with Christmas. We lost George Michael on Christmas Day 2016. It's just this horrible, horrible irony.
A man has been charged with dozens of offences against his wife, including drugging and raping her over a period of 13 years. Five other men are also accused of sexually assaulting Joanne Young in Swindon. The six men are due in court tomorrow. Two men have been jailed for using the dating app Grindr to trick victims into letting them into their homes before stealing their phones. 23-year-old Ramat Mohammadi and Mohammed Hotak, who's 27, would use the devices to make online payments and transfer themselves money. They were jailed for more than 8 years between them. The canal's been drained and boats swallowed up by a giant sinkhole in Shropshire. 10 people were rescued as large volumes of water escaped into land in Whitchurch early this morning. A major incident's been declared. Scott Hereford is from Shropshire Fire and Rescue Service.
It covers a significant area. If I was to articulate it to football pitches, it's probably four or five football pitches worth of water there, which is currently flooded.
And Banksy has confirmed he's behind a new artwork in London. The piece on a building in Bayswater shows a pair of children lying on the ground in winter wear, with one pointing up at a skyscraper. Another version is near Tottenham Court Road, but the elusive street artist hasn't said whether that's also his. In the city, the FTSE 100 has closed down 31 points at 98.65. The pound buys $1.34 and €1.14. LBC weather turning cloudy for most overnight. A few spots of rain developing in western areas, lows of 4. A murky day tomorrow with some light rain in the west. Some brighter spells for western areas too. Breezy in the south and east with highs of 10 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Katie Dartford.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Ian Dale.
Three minutes past nine on LBC. Welcome to the programme if you've just joined us. You've missed a cracking hour on languages, but we're still going to talk about it over the next hour because so many of you want to take part in the conversation. Larry Lamb has sparked this off. Remember Triangle, EastEnders, Gavin and Stacey? LBC presenter, used to present on Sunday mornings. Absolutely lovely man. Well, Tom Swarbrick spoke to him a little earlier, and he was saying that he thinks it's an absolute disgrace that more British people don't speak foreign languages, and I completely agree with him. I'm not surprised in some ways, because successive governments have diminished foreign language teaching in schools to the point where it's quite difficult to recruit German teachers, because, and I was going to be... When I went to university, that was what I was going to do, be a German teacher. Now, my life took on a bit of a different, turn. But, I mean, thank God I didn't in a way, because I think it's really difficult now for German teachers to get good positions in schools, because so few schools are now teaching German. And I've got a graph here, which unfortunately hasn't got figures on it, but it shows the decline in the number of people taking French and German and Spanish GCSEs over the last 20 or 30 years. It is absolutely frightening. But maybe we should be looking at other languages. If you speak, I was going to say a weird language, I won't say weird, but if you speak a language that most British people don't, why did you start to learn it? What's it given you? And let's continue asking the question, if you have learned a language, maybe later in life, what have you got out of it? And how would you encourage others to start learning a language, even if you are in your middle age or even older age? Because there's no limit to learning a language, is there? 0345 6060 973. And we're going to speak to Ulf in Hamburg during this hour, who's rung in. We could conduct the whole conversation in German, but that would be gratuitous and embarrassing, wouldn't it? Let's go to Claire, who's in Bangor in North Wales. Hello, Claire.
Actually Bangor in Northern Ireland.
Oh, I'm so sorry. How on earth did my producer listen to your voice, Claire, and put Bangor in North Wales on here?
I don't know, it's Northern Ireland, but I'm very interested in this topic because I started studying Italian when I took early retirement, and I find it very, very good. Now, I would agree with some of the previous callers who said that there is too much emphasis on grammar. Now, in Italian, there are 37 variations of the preposition. But if you're in Italy speaking to local Italians, they're not really worried about the grammar, and they will prompt you. And the best way to learn is from a local resident. They will prompt you. So when you're there, there's no point in saying, oh, get this grammar right, get this grammar right, but get the words out and get the conversation out, and that's the most important thing. And I've learned quite a lot, and I have an Italian friend who lives in the town near me from Milan, and I'm learning quite a lot from her, and she can understand my Italian. While the grammar may not be great, she can understand it. So, yes, I really enjoy a language, and I liked Latin when I was at school, and it's really good to learn a language. And when you're in Italy, you're not treated sort of as a tourist. Actually, when I was staying one year in the Amalfi Coast, a shopkeeper asked me to mind their shop while they took a break. So I thought that it really
was... That's a compliment, isn't it?
Yeah, I really was pleased about that, yes. So, I used to go to Italy every couple of years now.
Well, Italy is a fantastic country, and I think the Italian language, just from the way it sounds, is one of the most beautiful languages in the world, isn't it? And I remember when I started university, in the first year, I decided I would start learning Italian. But after six yes. weeks, it was taking up so much of my time. I was really enjoying it, but I thought, I can't justify this. And I did find it, I mean, going back to the grammar, with what you said, I mean, it's not easy to learn, and
it's
of course
not.
And it was, the whole course was based on learn the grammar first, then the rest will follow.
Yes, that's what's happened with me. And when I first started, we had about 10 people in the class, and the next couple of weeks it went down to 5.
Yeah.
So you know, the grammar sort of put them off, but I mean, you'll never be able to speak Italian like a local, but you know, you build up your knowledge and sort of read the books and do a little bit each day. And, you know, obviously if you're in the country taking holidays, you could pick up more in a week than, you know, you would from the books. But it is fascinating learning languages. I'm not much good at maths. I actually phoned in about before one time because I suffer from dyscalculia, but always enjoy languages.
And
dyscalculia.
What's
I phoned
that?
Up about it before. Well, I can add, subtract, multiply, divide, take percentages, but mathematical problems were beyond me. So, yes, I phoned up about that before, but always interested in the language, and it's just fascinating.
Well, it's fascinating to talk to you, Claire, particularly about Italian. And, I mean, have you ever been sort of tempted to learn Irish?
Well, I believe it's quite difficult too.
Yeah.
I believe it's difficult. Yeah.
Never too late. All right, Claire, thank you very much. Arrivederci. Let's go to Keith in Upminster. Hello, Keith.
Guten Abend.
Guten Abend.
I'm 2 or 3 years older than you, Ian. I left school in 76. But I learned French in school CSE grade D.
CSE grade 4 is terrible.
Grade 4. It's just below an O-level pass,
no,
isn't
it's
it?
Not.
Okay, well, I also got a GCE in English language and mathematics. But anyway, a few years later, I was in the Air Force in 79, and I served in Germany from 85 until 88. And I spoke, probably when I travelled out to Germany, I spoke about 4 words of German. But I went to the Abendschule in the colloquial German in the evenings, and it was about 40 years ago now that I was actually doing my German colloquial German. Anyway, fast forward to 1995, and I was on holiday in Spain with my mother, and I'd just been to the post office, so I knew exactly where the post office was in Ferrigno-Rola, and going back to the car, saw a Dutch couple who were trying to find the post office. And I didn't speak more than 3 or 4 words of Dutch, although I lived on the Dutch border in Germany when I was out there. And then they spoke French quite well. I spoke... So we were in France. I'm an English person talking to a Dutch couple in Spain and giving them directions to the post office in French.
And that's how it should be, isn't it? I mean, there are so many occasions
when we quickly worked out which languages we were common in. And by the way, which part of Germany did you live? Because you always say about you lived in Germany, or you visited.
Well, the first year, which was 1980 to 1981, I was in a town called Bad Wildungen, which is not far from Kassel. And the second year
that's close
was
to the border between the two parts of Germany.
Not that far. And then the second year, I was in a little village called Besigheim, which is not too far from Stuttgart, which was a real culture shock because southern Germany, as you well know, is very, very different to northern Germany.
It's Hochdeutsch, isn't it?
Absolutely. And where I was, it was a heavily accented area, Schwäbisch. And it was almost like, I mean, like Swiss German is a very... I mean, it is German, but not as we know it, as Captain Kirk might say. I found that a real challenge for the first few weeks.
Yes. Also, I travelled all over Germany, and I was a glider pilot while I was in the... Although I was a technician in the Air Force, I flew gliders at weekends and went to a few clubs in Germany near... Have you ever heard of Camp Lindfort in the Niederrhein?
No.
Okay, it's near Duisburg, anyway. But I went to there to a party because our local club was on the base at Laabruch, which is near Weitzer, and went to a party at our local German club, and that's when I very first started learning talking German, when I'd had quite a few beers in the evening and. So get talking to somebody who spoke a little bit of English. I spoke a little bit of German by then, and we were communicating by the end of the evening with hand signals as well.
How many of your colleagues, when you were going to evening classes, how many of your colleagues would go as well? How many of them could speak any German?
Oh, quite a few. And also our German teacher, who was a former linguist who'd worked in Berlin and Berlin and it's sort of right on the borders of East Germany, and he was fluent in Russian as well as in German, because obviously he'd been listening to the Russians and East Germans, and he one of his favourite things was that about Pravda nicht Izvestia and Izvestia nicht Pravda. I don't know if you know what that means.
I do. Do you want to tell us?
Well, truth is not information, and information is not truth.
Yeah.
Or something similar. Another thing we worked out between the two of us was that the Germans and the French never got on very well, because when they sat down at a table, it was der Tisch in German, but la table, so they couldn't even work out the gender of the table.
Well, there's a joke there somewhere, but we'd better not go there in these unenlightened times. Keith, thank you very much. Will Guyot, our tech correspondent, has been on the line. He says Apple's latest headphones can translate multiple languages in real time. You see, again, that's going to feed into the narrative that we really don't need to learn languages if we have these headphones, I suppose. Keep your calls coming, 0345 6060 973. Why do you think it is that so many British people don't really feel the need to learn a new language? And when you go and live in another country, how long does it take you to get into that language? We're going to talk to somebody who's phoning in from Japan in a moment. And I mean, I don't know any Japanese. Do I know any Japanese words? Nope, can't think of a single one. Sushi. Konnichiwa. Yeah, that's Chris has just told me. Yeah, I do know that. But, I mean, I imagine that is a pretty difficult language to learn. So we'll take more of your calls for the next 45 minutes on this, I think, really, really interesting subject. Hope you do too. 16 minutes past 9.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
They come here because they know it's a soft touch.
Straight to the point.
How does this even add up?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
This is a Whitehall farce, without any doubt.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Hey, Harry.
Hello, mate.
Any tips for the racing?
Yeah. Your best bet is to enter BetVictor for their new customer welcome offer. If you bet a minimum of £10, they give you £20 in free bets on the horse racing. But here's another tip. If you're at the races, head to the paddock. You get lots of info they don't put in the race cards.
Like what?
Like the fact I'm seeing one of them drop a lot of weight right now.
Oh. Listen to Harry and make your best bet on the racing at BetVictor. 18 plus, opt in, bet on horse racing at odds of evens or greater, no cash out, 7-day expiry, terms and conditions apply, gambleaware.org.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
Waitrose presents...
I really fancy a mince pie.
One man's selfless journey
From sofa to kitchen.
I'm getting up.
For a number one golden mince pie with juicy golden raisins, cherries and apricots, and zesty limoncello.
With some cream.
For a number one golden mince pie with juicy golden raisins, cherries and apricots, zesty limoncello, and a dollop of fresh cream.
Limoncello.
Waitrose, the home of food lovers. Selected stores subject to availability.
Serious about the right vitamins for you and your family? Trust Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company, for expert nutritional care for every age and lifestyle. Vitamins for everyone, including Well Man, Well Woman, Well Baby, and Well Kid. From Boots, pharmacies, and Vitabiotics.com. For number one verification, see Vitabiotics.com.
Ian Dale, text 84850. This is LBC.
18 minutes past nine. Now, I know people are thinking this is a really good programme because we haven't had a lot of politics so far. Well, Donald Trump is about to speak about, shall we say, relations with Venezuela, which aren't too, well, they are quite hot at the moment, but not very warm, if you see what I mean. So if he does start speaking before the end of this hour, we will go to it live because I suspect it's going to be quite an event. Right, I promised you a caller from Japan, and I'm now going to attempt the place that he's calling in from. It's Ian in Kitakyashu. Did I get that anywhere near right, Ian?
It's close, Ian. It's Kitakyushu.
That's near enough, okay. Isn't it? Yeah.
That's pretty close. It's very good for a first shot. Anyway, konbanwa. I'm just trying to increase your Japanese, so that's good evening.
Thank you.
And ohayou gozaimasu where I am, because it's 6:20 in the morning here.
That's me. So be your breakfast show.
All right. Yes. Well, I was listening to you at 5 in the morning, and I couldn't bring myself to call you then, but I can just about manage this time.
So do you speak Japanese?
I certainly do. I've been here since 1988.
Oh, wow.
Continuously. My wife's Japanese. Our interactions at home are almost all in Japanese. Well, to explain a bit more, it's going to take a little while, but I studied French and German for the first year at university. Then I did law for 2 years, thinking, I need to branch out a bit. And I then went into accountancy in London. We're talking 1978, born 1956. And anyway, so accountancy didn't suit me, or I didn't suit it, or whatever. And I was quite glad to fail the second year exams, which was a blessing in disguise in the end. I went into language teaching in the UK, which is, I did French and German. Obviously, I fell back on what I already had, as it were. And I did that until I was about 30. And then I sort of felt, somehow I loved languages so much that I wanted to try something much harder. And I was still single, so I had the mobility. So I was able to find a job teaching English in Japan. And it was a 1 year contract, and I was on sort of 1 year and then 3 year contract for 6 years in the Kansai, which is the middle of, west of Tokyo, but it's east of where I am now. So 6 years there, and then I got a university job, very fortunately, here in Kitakyushu on the island of Kyushu. Okay.
Are you still with me? Yes, no, I am. I'm fascinated, partly because what you've done mirrors a friend of mine who has gone down exactly the same route as you. I can't remember why he went to Japan in the first place, but he ended up teaching. And I think about 15 years on, 20 years on probably now, he's still there. He's married a Japanese lady and is now he's not Japanese, but he obviously knows the language very, very well. And he's seen, I think, from what I can gather from his mother, who's sort of, I speak to quite often, he absolutely adores it there.
Yep. I'm in the same boat. So, I mean, for me, it was the fresh start to end all fresh starts, if you know what I mean. I just needed something, a new challenge. And I thought, well, I already had a little bit. My father had been in commerce and had helped set up an office for an engineering company in Tokyo, a British company. And so he brought me back a silk tie when I was 16. I think the silk tie had a sort of profound effect. I don't know, but I've always loved languages, and I've always felt confident, and it's been my strong suit. I don't know if it's having good ears or what it is, but it's probably a combination of things. But at any rate, you know, I agree. I love the place. And you were talking earlier about Dutch people switching to English as soon as they know you're British, right?
Yeah.
It's almost the reverse here, because I think Japanese people are so relieved to speak Japanese rather than battle through in English, because they're real perfectionists, and it really makes it difficult for them to learn languages. You know, they sort of you can watch them as they're trying to speak English, and it's like they're calculating the grammar in their head, or they're trying to work out now is it is or are
yeah.
is it, you know. And by the time you've done that, you've lost the conversation completely. It doesn't happen, you know.
And do you think in Japanese? Do you dream in Japanese?
Oh, well, I don't know about dreaming. I don't do much dreaming anyway these days. But yes, I think I probably do think in Japanese, because I, you know, I've got lots of friends here. I'm playing rugby in a rugby club here, and I'm the only, well, I'm not quite the only foreigner. There's now a young British guy there, but I've sort of immersed myself deliberately. And as far as how whether Japanese is a difficult language, I was explaining to your staff that the first thing, of course, is to learn to speak it. And speaking is really not so hard, strange to say, or perhaps not strange, but because, well, if you immerse yourself, as I did, I was in schools teaching English, but I was sort of within a Japanese working environment. So I was hearing Japanese the whole time. I had my little notebook for the first 6 months, and every time I heard a new word, it would go in the notebook. And, you know, I'd check it later if necessary. But so speaking is, most people, and I'm saying people not with a particular aptitude for languages even, can learn to speak the language quite well in 6 months. What is really hard is reading and writing, which takes 5 years of solid study, I would say, to get somewhere worthwhile. Yeah, so that's the difference. It's such a fascinating thing to study the written language, and it's so complicated, you know. But you begin to see patterns after a while.
And is there a Japanese version of LBC?
Good question. I'm not aware of one, but I'm quite happy using LBC.
I think I'm going to suggest to my boss, LJC, Leading Japan's Conversation. There's a gap in the market.
Oh, wow. Well, that sounds interesting. Yeah, I'd be up for that.
Well, you could be a presenter on it, given your linguistic skills.
I would be happy. Yeah. I'd have to do that.
All right, Ian, thank you very much indeed. Hope you have a lovely day. Right, Kathy says, not exactly a faux pas, but it certainly caused hassle. When I was teaching English in an Italian school in Rome, as part of my Italian degree, I had a lot of spare time to get to know Rome. I decided to go to an art gallery by bus, so asked the driver to drop me off at the Galleria. He dropped me off in the middle of a great long tunnel, who knows where. Little did I know, Galleria also means tunnel in Italian. Well, I can see that would have been a bit of hassle. What's a strange word for tunnel? Roger is in Cushalton. Hello, Roger.
Hi. I love this show you're doing at the moment, Ian. I watch you from time to time. I like the political stuff, but this is even more interesting.
Well, it's great that it's Christmas, because during the rest of the year, I can't carry on a subject for 2 hours, because we have cross-question in the middle of the programme, so I'm really enjoying this.
But learning languages is so fun. You know, I used to go hitchhiking when I was a kid. That's my early interest. And I had a friend. And we used to be hitchhiking around Scotland, because I'm from the northwest originally. And he'd stop people on the road, usually young people doing what we were doing, which was basically hitchhiking and youth hosteling, which was very popular in those days in the late 50s. And he'd stop these people and start talking in about five different languages, you know, Palermo, Italiano, and and all of this. And this caught on, and I thought, this is a great way of communication. One day we met a group of guys, and we said, he did this thing, he did his tricks, you know, all the five languages. And these guys looked at him straight and said, oh, so what are you talking about with the Liverpool?
Oh, a thought comes to mind, but I'm not going to say it. No, Chris says no, I shouldn't.
This guy, funnily enough, he ended up, I found him again in Facebook. I knew him in the 50s in Blackpool. He went around the world like I have, and I'm in London now, but he's in Northern Australia. And he's got a PhD, believe it or not, in Australian Aboriginal language.
Wow. And there aren't many of those to the pound.
But I love languages. You can use it all the time and anywhere. And I like the fact you're pretty good at German, you know. And I've always tried to study it. It's hard, but that lady was quite right about the grammar. Forget the grammar. And what I'm using now is AI, an AI app. And anytime I have an issue with the language, I go to that, right? You know, because you've got grammatical points in all languages. It's hard to do. Mm. The other thing was, about 10 years ago, I started with Duolingo. I don't know if you've heard of this.
I have, yes.
Now, Duolingo, if you just stick to the one without ads, and not the super family one, costs you about 50 quid a year.
And that's not a lot, is it, to learn a language?
Not a lot. Now, what I do, I stay with the competition. So I've got an hour in the morning, because I'm retired anyway. You've got from 6 in the morning till 12 to do the first section. It's like a competition, but it keeps you on the ball. I've been doing it for 10 years and I've stuck with it. And in the evening from 6 o'clock onwards, again, for 20 minutes. And you're in a competition. And I'm studying, at the moment I'm doing Welsh. I'm doing French and German. The reason I'm doing Welsh is because my dad was from North Wales. And what else am I doing? My wife is from Thailand. And that's
a wicked laugh.
Well, I know. The thing about Thai is tones. And you get, there's a thing, I don't know, there's a trick about the word my. And if you get the wrong tone, it's either silk, no, question, burn, and things like that.
Oh, that's quite difficult, isn't it?
But the trick with Thai is don't learn a word, learn a phrase like I don't know or how are you.
Mm.
If you get fluent in 3 or 4 words in a section, like, you know, couldn't you deny means what are you doing? Now, I don't know if I'm saying it right, but every time I look at a Thai person, they usually smile.
Well, I know somebody who is probably in his late 60s, and he married a Thai lady about 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Neither of them can speak the other's language. They couldn't they couldn't 20 years ago, and they still can't. And yet somehow they communicate.
But my wife doesn't want me to understand Thai. Because when she's talking to her friends, she's sitting with me in the car now, she's driving and she's smiling. I can understand what she's talking about. But the funny thing about Thai, one of the most awkward things about Thai is you don't know they're talking about you. Because they don't know your name, they give you a title.
What is yours, Roger? I dread to ask.
Well, it's quite a common one for Thai. They use the word fen, which almost translates as fan, and it's either boyfriend or husband.
Oh.
But they will never say, she'll never say Roger. She'll never say Roger, so I don't know it's me. But when she says fen this and fen that, I know it's me, yeah? But they also have another funny thing. When they're talking to their parents, and my wife's in her 40s now, they call themselves, they don't say D-chan, which is I in female, they say nu, which means mouse.
Well, that's odd.
And also they have other little words like that, you know. There's other words that they use when they're talking to friends, you know, which are personal pronouns. Instead of saying I, whatever, they'll use, when she talks to mum, she's a mouse.
And when you talk to a mother, you're a rat.
Possibly. Yeah.
Now, it says here on my screen, Roger, and I can't believe this, that you're 86 years old.
Yes, I am.
So you have a wife in her early 40s who's clearly keeping you young, because you do not sound anything like everyone imagines an 86-year-old would sound.
Oh, super. Thanks for that, Ian. Thank you very, very much. No, I've always liked young people, and I've been married 3 times, and I've got 2 families, from wife number 1, who was British, wife number 2, who was Filipino, and now I'm in Thailand.
Well, I would say just stop there and don't go to any other country, because you might be tempted.
Well, not really. One thing I like about Thailand is they have a very strong sense of duty and family. They look after you.
Yeah.
Right? So she watches me. If I'm out in the countryside walking or something like that, she's keeping an eye on me if I trip up. Stuff like that.
You see, if she wasn't driving, I'd want to have a word with her now. but she is, so I won't. Mrs. Roger, you've got a diamond there, haven't you? I think she...
Well, yeah, they also have these long names, which are unpronounceable, but they have nicknames.
Go on.
So her nickname is Jazz, as in the music.
Right.
So, but her long name is Thatchery.
Thatchery?
Thatchery with a P.
Oh, I thought it was Thatchery. If it was Thatchery, I'd like her even more. Roger, we have to go. Thank you very much indeed. Donald Trump speaking about Venezuela in a few minutes' time, or it may well be delayed, because these things often are. In fact, I hope it is, to be honest, because I want to continue with your calls. It's 9:32. Let's get the news headlines from Katie Dartford.
The singer behind the classic festive hit Driving Home for Christmas has died. Chris Rea has passed away at the age of 74 following a short illness. A man's been charged with drugging and raping his ex-wife over 13 years. Five others have also been handed charges over sexual offences against Joanne Young, who's waived her anonymity. They'll all appear at Swindon Magistrates Court tomorrow. Part of a canal has been blocked off in Shropshire after its banks broke, triggering a major incident. More than 10 people had to be rescued and several narrowboats were left stranded in Whitchurch earlier. And the government claims an app coming next year that gives users fuel prices in real time should help drive down prices. The competition watchdog says drivers are still paying too much, calling retailers' profits persistently high. LBC weather turning cloudy for most overnight, a few spots of rain developing in western areas, lows of 4 degrees.
This is LBC.
Think about cheese. Make your thoughts cheesier. Now add 100% chicken breast fillet, chipotle sauce and a mega cheese melt. And it's giving the new cheesy chicken stack at McDonald's. Did we mention it's cheesy?
Cheese.
Available until the 4th of Jan 2026 from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
Serious about the right vitamins for you and your family? Trust Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company, for expert nutritional care for every age and lifestyle. Vitamins for everyone, including well man, well woman, well baby and well kid. From Boots, pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com. For number one verification, see Vitabiotics.com.
This Christmas Eve, the £50 million Lotto jackpot must be won.
Must be won.
Must be won.
Must be won.
Yes, the £50 million Lotto jackpot must be won on Christmas Eve. There's magic in the air, so get your ticket today. Lotto from the National Lottery. It could be you. Rules and procedures apply. Players must be 18 or over.
Merry Christmas, my love.
Merry Christmas, Mum.
Merry Christmas, Nanny.
Happy New Year!
From the UK's first mobile phone call to the first text, we've been connecting you at Christmas since 1984 on Vodafone, the nation's network. The nation's network, Vodafone UK, supporting the nation since 1984. Learn more at vodafone.co.uk/TNN.
This is LBC with Ian Dale. Call 0345 6060 973.
9:35, if you've just tuned in, we are talking about the lack of interest in foreign languages among many people in this country, certainly the government, successive governments, going back to, I would say, probably Tony Blair's time, have diminished the importance of language teaching in schools, I think disgracefully. Same thing's happening in universities. When you've got the University of Kent, you've got UEA now, don't have language departments. I think I'm right in saying that about the University of Kent. Better be careful, seeing as they gave me an honorary doctorate there this year. I think that there is something wrong when language teaching in schools and universities has just been relegated in importance. And it's going to be very difficult to reverse that trend, I think, because so few people are now training to be language teachers in this country. And maybe the solution to this is to encourage more teaching of Spanish, Arabic, Mandarin, languages that are actually going to be really, really useful for students in the future. Let's go to Nadi, who's a first-time caller in Hampstead. Hello, Nadi.
Hello, Ian. Thank you so much for the time. And just to let you know, this is the first time I ever call a radio station, but I thought the subject was so important that I could not resist the temptation to call you.
I'm very glad you haven't resisted.
So, you know, I happen to be fortunate enough to speak 8 or 9 languages, but I have learned them very, very carefully. So I can say that I speak all those languages. And the reason why I do, first, although I was British born, but I was brought up in a family where we spoke three languages to start with. My father being from Lebanon, my mother from Malta. So we spoke, obviously, English, French, and Arabic. This is the basic languages. And then I learned German at school. And then I did A-level Japanese. And I heard your guest from Japan. I was very interested to hear him. He's lived in Japan. But I make use of those languages. Like, I was in Japan in Hiroshima in February, and I gave a speech in Japanese because I'm happy to be a doctor, a surgeon, so I get invited to many congresses. So you gave
a medical speech in Japanese?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And I prepared it very well. For 3 months prior to flying, I got a Japanese teacher to listen to my speech, almost every other day coming to my office. And I perfected it. And I knew when I landed in Hiroshima that I could do it. And I have to say, as the guest said, they were so impressed because, you know, a lot of them can't speak English.
Did you get a standing ovation?
I indeed had a standing ovation.
Well, I mean, that is quite something to achieve.
You know, before me, there was an American professor, a lady, so ladies first. She stood up and said a few words that nobody listened to. And here I am, standing up, picking up the paper from my pocket, inside pocket, and I read that whole speech, and I tell you, they were literally stunned. So this is what I make use of languages, and I think the youngsters listening should really listen to this, because what you have done today, Ian, is so important. Nothing functions without languages. It's impossible. I mean, as I said, I'm a doctor. I look after French patients. I look after Arabic patients. I look after Jewish patients. I speak Hebrew, Arabic, Italian, German, etc., Russian. You know, I was in Russia as a visiting professor, invited by the Russians, you know, a few years ago, just because I spoke Russian. At that time, I was in the U.S., so I was invited by the Russians to go and visit. So I spoke Russian. So this is what I think is so important to make use of those skills. And I tell you, it makes such a big difference.
I mean, you are basically a living example of AI in action, aren't you?
Yeah. You know, this is why, you know, I heard somebody making use of AI. Obviously, AI is another tool, but I think it's so much more important to yourself be the speaker without making use of AI. And I tell you, you make so much impression whenever, you know, when I go, whether in Germany, you said you were about to become a German teacher. You know, when I go to Germany, I speak German. Obviously, no one is 100% fluent if it's not your native language. Nobody can claim they speak it perfectly well. But I manage very well. I was in Paris over the weekend. You know, people think I'm French when I'm in Paris. So this is how, and I like to perfect first, you know, the linguistic skills, the accent as much as possible, so that people appreciate what you're doing. And I think this is the only way people can progress in life. That's what I think.
Well, look, listen, I think everybody has really enjoyed your call, Nadi. I think you're a living legend. If you can speak 8 or 9 languages, some of them obviously very, very fluently. And congratulations on the standing ovation in Japan. I think we can all dream of occasions like that. Joanna is in Sudbury Hill in North London. Hello, Joanna.
Oh, hello, Ian. Oh, it's a lovely conversation that you're having now of languages. Yes, I was so impressed, so I thought, let me join in. And yes, I learned 4 languages in South Africa. I learned Afrikaans from when I was 2 years old.
I love the sound of Afrikaans. I think it's an absolutely beautiful language, but I think I'm in a minority on that.
Yeah, unfortunately, I lost it. Because it's strange, I can't explain it, because I was at school one day, and we passed English, and we were failed in English. We passed English, and we were failed in English and all the things that we passed, because we didn't pass Afrikaans. And we were all shocked about that, and the teachers were very upset. I was so upset. The following day when I woke up, I couldn't speak it. I couldn't speak Afrikaans at all.
Really?
Even now, when I listen to it, I can just a little bit here and there.
Because before you said that you were from South Africa, I thought you were, I thought you were French. That was what your accent said to me. But now you've said you're from South Africa, I can kind of hear it. But you haven't got the traditional South African accent, have you?
Wow. Well, I don't want to lose it.
No, honestly, you sound French.
Wow. I've never heard anybody saying that.
Really?
I may sure learn it. Yes, I'm actually Sotho myself. But from a township, I learned by ear and by looking at what people are talking or what they are doing.
Yeah.
And I learned English that way as well. I was in school for a short time, and so I couldn't pick it up there. But I picked it up when I started working in town. Because as I was saying to the gentleman before I came into you, that I didn't have papers to travel around or even to go into town. I was just working for people in the township, my own people in the township. One day a lady was looking for somebody to work for her, and a lady opposite where I lived, because I was living with people around, I didn't have a home. And the lady, I got to the lady eventually, and she, one day then she said she's going to find me papers, which I couldn't understand, because she didn't talk to me about whether I've got papers or not. And then she took a month off, because it takes a long time just to go to one place. And eventually she got the papers. And on the way, going home, she said to me, now that you've got papers, you'll have to go to town to find yourself a job. And I was shocked. Why? Because I was so used to work for her. And plus, they accepted me so much and all. And then she said, no, you haven't done anything. From today, you are the child of the house, but I want you to explore. And the following day, she gave me money, and she said to me, I must go to town and find a job. She just showed me the bus stop, and I had to go by myself. And when I got there, I asked somebody where I can go to find a job. I was pointed to an agency. But when I got to the job, I got the job. For the first time, I'm working for white people. I was so excited because I like to learn languages, and English is, I wanted to learn it a lot. So the first day, the lady called her son, and so I translate in my head, in my language. And so she called him. And he said, Mom, and I thought, oh, he said, Mom, what's Mom? So let me see. He came running to Mom. And Mom said, bring me a plate. And so I thought, plate? So what's that? And then so, okay, let me wait. The boy ran back, and he came holding the plate. So I'm translating my head, oh, plate is this. And that's how I went on, like working in a house with everything around the house. About 3 weeks, I could speak English, because it's almost like as if I live with them.
Yeah.
Because I'm in bed the whole
day. Yeah, and you just pick it up all the time, don't you? Just to say, I wasn't going mad. Niall has just texted me to say, I thought this lady has a French accent too. So it's not just me. But with that anecdote that you've just told, there were definite South African sounds there.
Wow.
Thank you very much indeed, Joanna. It's 9:47.
Coming up at 10 on LBC, Ben Kentish.
The new head of Britain's Equalities Watchdog speaks out about the demonisation of migrants. Has she got a point? Plus, why is the government classing train drivers earning 80k a year as working class?
Ben Kentish at 10. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Merry Christmas, my love.
Merry Christmas, Mum.
Merry Christmas, Nanny.
Happy New Year!
From the UK's first mobile phone call to the first text, we've been connecting you at Christmas since 1984 on Vodafone, the nation's network. The nation's network, Vodafone UK, supporting the nation's